Well, good Wednesday morning. I'm Rick Clough. This is the early edition for the 29th day now of November. Yep, we're getting ever closer to December 1st. Open House and Food Bank Day here at the CBC. Tell you more about that through the morning. Weather today, well, a little cloudy, could be a little wet, could be a little foggy, could be a little warm. I'll have some of the little details for you in just a couple of moments. Coming up in this half hour of the program, as you know, the Prime Minister delivered an emotional apology yesterday to the LGBTQ2 Canadians for years of laws and policies that discriminated against them because of their sexual orientation, and it destroyed many, many lives. We're going to talk to a law professor for his reaction on this and his thoughts on the next steps. That's coming up. But first, Drew Carrick is with headlines from our CBC Vancouver newsroom.
Good morning, Rick. Vancouver police have issued a warning about a sexual predator who is now living in a halfway house in the city. They believe Christian Otto Olsen poses a significant risk of reoffending. The mayor of Port Coquitlam has decided 10 years of civic politics is enough. Greg Moore has decided not to seek re-election next year, although he says there's still a lot he wants to accomplish in his remaining time. And the number of injured songbirds is up significantly this autumn, and bird watchers say there could be a link to the devastating wildfires this past summer. More local and regional news coming up at 5:30.
Thank you, sir. A little windy out there. I didn't see any rain this morning, but it's a possibility. It's in the forecast.
Later in the day, for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. Becoming cloudy this morning, then periods of rain this afternoon, fog patches through the early morning hours, and windy near the water this afternoon, and a high of 9 degrees. So, once again, mild, but we've got all the other elements thrown in there. Rain overnight, a low of 6. Tomorrow, the rain should end sometime in the afternoon, giving way to cloudy skies and a possibility of further showers, and windy near the water tomorrow morning, and a high of 8. And then we look at Friday, and the reason I'm looking at Friday is because it's our 31st annual Open House and Food Bank Day here at CBC. Calls for rain. It's all right. People are coming inside.
That's right.
Yeah.
It's nice and warm in here.
Yeah. Yeah, and we invite everybody down because they throw open the doors at 6 o'clock.
Yeah.
And close them at 6 o'clock, and in between it's just madness.
But fun.
Yeah, we've got lots. All the shows are being done live, of course, starting with us on the early edition. Then you'll see BC Almanac, an elongated version thereof.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, Stephen Quinn.
That's right.
And on the coast. And we invite you to come on down and be part of the fun, and also to think about the food bank of your choice anywhere in BC where you might want to direct some of your cash.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
That festive red button on the website.
Yes. Go look for the – if you can donate right now, cbc.ca/BC, look for the Open House Food Bank Day banner. Click on that and then click on the Donate Now button. If you make a donation of $20 or more, you get a tax receipt almost instantly.
It's kind of like an early Christmas present.
It is. It is. And keeping in mind that for every dollar we raise on Friday, food banks across BC can treble that.
That's right.
So it'll be 3 to 4 times more.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. All right, sir. Come down and meet Drew Carrickus. He'll be here, as will Amy Bell, in about 15 minutes' time. You're listening to the early edition here on CBC Radio 1. Well, the Prime Minister has made a historic apology to the LGBTQ2 Canadians in the public service, acknowledging the federal government's long history of discrimination against them.
To all the LGBTQ2 people across this country who we have harmed in countless ways, we are sorry. To those who were left broken by a prejudiced system, and to those who took their own lives, we have failed you. For stripping you of your dignity, for robbing you of your potential, for treating you like you were dangerous, indecent, and flawed, we are sorry.
For more on the apology, we're joined this morning by Kyle Kirkup. Kyle is a professor at the Faculty of Law at the University of Ottawa, where he is on the line this morning. Kyle, good morning.
Good morning.
How historically significant is this apology?
I think it's profoundly historically significant. I was actually in the room with some survivors as the apology was being delivered. And just being in the room and feeling the pain that a lot of people had, the shame, the humiliation, the way that lives were upended, being there, with people who had experienced kind of profound levels of discrimination, and listening to the Prime Minister get up in the House of Commons and apologize, I think was an important step in trying to redress some of the harms that so many experienced.
You say you were there in the room. How did you feel personally when you heard that apology delivered?
It was very emotional in a lot of ways. I happen to have been born in a time where same-sex rights, LGBTQ rights were really changing. And so I thought, you know, if I had been born one generation or two generations before, my life probably would have looked very different. And so thinking about people that were in the room that had kind of opened doors and made it more easy for people like myself to live authentic, open, happy lives. It was just a really important day to be there.
Yeah. Can you take us back in time, remind us, for those who might not know what it was like in the 60s, and about those discriminatory policies from past decades?
Yeah, so if we kind of go all the way back to early Confederacy, the criminal code in Canada has a long history of targeting same-sex sexual activities. This kind of happened over and over again. There was a famous case that went to the Supreme Court that was brought against a man named Everett Clippert. He was engaged in same-sex sexual activities with other men up in the Northwest Territories. The police found out about it. He was charged, convicted, and then he was basically put into indefinite detention, where he was not able to have his liberty to leave because he was deemed to be a so-called incurable homosexual. So that was kind of happening. What was happening on the criminal front, and then within the federal government, you saw, you know, a kind of a categorical bar against people being out in the RCMP, in the military, in the public service, and you saw the Canadian government engage in a series of practices to basically try to figure out who are the true homosexuals, and then how do we basically pull them out of any aspect of the Canadian government. They even hired a professor at Carleton University to develop what was then called the fruit machine, which was a tool that was built to try to figure out who are the true homosexuals by showing them a series of images and then seeing how they reacted. And so we sometimes forget that you know, that this is a part of Canada's history. It's a history that really extends all the way into the early 1990s, so very recent memory. And so obviously an important step to think that we went from the fruit machine to the Prime Minister standing in the House of Commons apologizing.
The reason I mentioned the 60s as a decade is because Pierre Trudeau, this Prime Minister's father, was the one who made that famous speech about the government has no right in the bedrooms of Canadians. And yet it still took 50 years for this apology to come.
That's right. And actually, the Prime Minister mentioned his father in some of his remarks, thinking about, you know, the fact that his father, who was then Minister of Justice, who had introduced some criminal code reforms in 67, which were then passed in 69, that started to decriminalize homosexuality. And I think that, you know, sometimes the Prime Minister is grappling with what more could have been done in the intervening years, and what can we do moving forward to make sure that, you know, in 50 years, there's not another Prime Minister who needs to get up in the House of Commons and apologize for current dynamics.
Which is my final question to you, Kyle. What do we do from this point forward?
So I would say we, for many people who are marginalized members of LGBT communities, they continue to find themselves targeted by the criminal law, trans people, racialized people, poor people. There's still a lot of work to be done in our criminal legal system. So that would be one area that I'd like to see more reforms happen. And then another area is the ban on donating blood. So if you're a man who has sex with men, or you're a trans woman who has sex with men, you're categorically barred from giving blood for a period of 1 year. So the Liberals have said that they're going to look at changing this. There's apparently some research and study happening at the moment, but I think that we need to kind of translate some of the symbolism into concrete laws and policies.
Kyle Kirkup, thank you so much for joining us this morning. We very much appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Kyle Kirkup, professor at the Faculty of Law at the University of Ottawa, and he was on the line with us from Ottawa. It is now 20 minutes past 5 o'clock here on CBC Radio 1. Hey, the list of 2018 Grammy nominees, Grammy nominees, was released yesterday. Top four categories for the music prize are heavily dominated by rap and R&B artists. American rapper Jay-Z is the leader in the nominations with 8 in total. Noticeably absent from the list of Grammy nominees this year is the Canadian musician Drake. Hip-hop superstar chose not to submit his release, More Life, to the award show, saying hip-hop isn't getting the respect it deserves and the awards don't reflect its huge popularity. From More Life, here's Drake with Passion Fruit.
Listen, seeing you got ritualistic, cleansing my soul of addiction for now, 'cause I'm falling apart. Tension between us just like picket fences. You got issues that I won't mention for now, 'cause we're falling apart. Passionate from miles away, passive with the things you say, passing up on my old ways. I can't blame you, no. Passionate from miles away, passive with the things you say, passing up on my own ways. I can't blame you, no, no. From a distance, I think we should rule out commitment for now, 'cause we're falling apart. Leaving, you're just doing that to get even. Don't pick up the pieces, just leave it for now. They keep falling apart. Passionate from miles away, passive with the things you say, passing up on my old ways. I can't blame you, no, no. Passionate from miles away, passive with the things you say, passing up on my old ways. I can't blame you, no.
There you go. That's Drake with Passion Fruit from his album More Life. And you'll hear more about Drake passing up on the Grammys this year. That's coming up at 10 to 6. It is now 23 minutes past 5 o'clock here on CBC Radio 1. Hey, is it possible to turn back the clock on your face? All those creams and lifts and fillers and lasers, do any of them actually work? And at what cost? Well, our midlife hacker, Shelley Joyce, went in search of some answers.
If you ever want to know the truth about yourself, ask your teenagers.
When you look at my face, what do you see?
Beauty. I think wrinkles indicate laughing and happiness because you have eye wrinkles and you have smile wrinkles. I think those are the best wrinkles you could hope for. So,
frown wrinkles aside, I feel like a teenager on the inside, but the outer package starting to look a little bit weathered. Dr. Brian Peterson is a plastic surgeon who specializes in aesthetic surgical procedures, facelifts, eyelid surgery, chin augmentation, that kind of thing. He says his clients are just like me. They spend lots of time eating well and doing yoga or running or riding their bikes, so they're somewhat shocked when they pass a mirror.
Increased eyelid skin, sagging facial skin, and the vast majority of the people I see a different person in the mirror than they feel. And I think that's a very common feature, is they'll walk by a mirror and they'll suddenly see themselves and go, gosh, who's that old person when I feel so good inside?
Dr. Peterson says a plastic surgeon can slice about a decade off the face as long as the patient is in good health. The fatal flaw when it comes to aging?
I would say in the lower facial area, it's the formation of jowls and loose neck skin that people refer to as a turkey neck. Around the eyes, excess upper eyelid skin or baggy fullness of the lower eyelids are signs of aging and a fatigued look. And people are tired of people asking them if they're tired all the time.
Oh, and you know those little wrinkles that we get around the mouth, those smoker's lines? Well, have you noticed that men don't get them? There's a really unfair reason for that.
Men, we have bearded skin. It's much thicker, and so we never form those lines, but you do see them in women. So resurfacing that area, either with a laser or a dermabrasion, which is actually a sanding of the skin, you can erase those lines kind of like cracks in wood.
If you want bang for your buck, Dr. Peterson says Botox is the way to go, followed by fillers. But less is more.
Well, a little is good. A lot is not necessarily better. And I think that people come in wanting more and more. And at some point, it's our responsibility to say, you look great now. I think if we keep going, you are going to have that very unnatural look.
So if Botox isn't your thing, most skin clinics offer a wide range of solutions. There are fillers like Juvederm, lasers like the Thermafrax, and pharmaceutical-grade retinoid-type creams that have been scientifically proven to restructure damaged skin. You need a prescription for those. Anything that you buy over-the-counter is kind of just a jar full of promises. Dr. Richard Lewis is a dermatologist. He's been in the business for 45 years, and at the age of 77, he is still treating patients and trying out all the age-defying strategies on himself.
I have had Botox, fillers, laser resurfacing, vascular laser, CO2 laser, and retinoic acid, and of course, sunscreen and sun protection since I smartened up when I was in my early 20s. The most effective was my laser resurfacing that I had done probably, oh goodness, close to 15, 20 years ago. And it has maintained the smooth skin that I have in my cheeks. I've also had eyelid surgery. You know, the upper eyelid sometimes gets a little saggy. If I smile like this, what you see in my cheeks is mostly filler.
Oh. So what would your cheeks look like if you didn't have the filler in there?
They'd be about an inch lower.
If you were to make a recommendation for this face, would you say laser? Would you say filler? Would you say check them all off, all of the above?
All of the above, except I don't see any eyelid problem. I don't think you have any saggy eyelids, so I wouldn't touch your eyelids.
That was humbling. My hunch on all this, though, is to start small. You know, a little pharmaceutical-grade retinoic acid cream? And pile on the broccoli and the yoga. Maybe the teenagers are right on this. The small wrinkles are the best wrinkles you can hope for. For CBC Radio, I'm Shelley Joyce.
Thank you, Shelley. And Shelley Joyce is the host of Daybreak Kamloops, who's coming to grips coping with middle age. Amy Bell is here. You have none of those issues.
No.
No. How are you this morning?
I've got some other issues, but it's fine.
How are things out there?
We have a couple of problems, actually. In Agassiz, Highway 7 is down to single-lane alternating traffic just east of Agassiz at Wallich Road, and that was from an earlier crash. And then in Abbotsford, because of an earlier crash, Bradner Road is closed from Fraser Highway to Simpson. It's not because of the collision. It's the power lines that were brought down. So we will let you know, and you can get through there. But detours set up in both areas. Volume still light for all the major routes, but we'll see that changing. And we're going to see more clouds coming in this morning. And then we will see periods of rain later on this afternoon. Windy near the water and a high of 9. Very rainy overnight, about 20 to 30 millimeters. And the winds will persist near the water. We'll drop down to 6 degrees. And then that rain will taper to showers tomorrow afternoon. High of 8. Showers Thursday night, back into the rain for Friday and Saturday, but then a mix of sun and cloud on Sunday.
Nice.
Yeah.
Nice. But Food Bank Day, we encourage people to come in from the outdoors.
So it'll be all cozy in here.
So come on in.
Come on in.
And say hi to us. Day after tomorrow, our 31st annual Food Bank Day here
on
CBC. It's crazy. Yeah, it is. And we'll be on the air in Studio 700. And you can come in and see the early edition go to air with our special guests like David Suzuki is going to be here, Christopher
yep.
Gaze.
Yep.
All sorts of music playing with the Sojourners and Corleone.
It's going to be great.
Yeah, it's going to be fun. That's Friday, our 31st annual Open House and Food Bank Day. It's 5:30, time for the news. Here's Drew Karakas.
Good morning. It's 2 degrees and partly cloudy in Vancouver. Vancouver police say a convicted sex offender has been released from custody and is now living in a halfway house in the city. Investigators say Christian Otto Olsen poses a significant risk of committing sexual offenses against children. The CBC's Mira Baines reports.
Vancouver police have released a statement warning the public about 35-year-old Christian Otto Olsen. He's been convicted of crimes including sexual assault, child pornography offenses, and sexual interference and touching. Police say that Federal Correctional Services have assessed Olsen as being at a very high risk of sexually reoffending. He's living in a Vancouver halfway house. Olsen's release is bound by several court-imposed conditions. They include that he must wear an electronic monitoring device and not be near places where children congregate, such as schools, parks, and rec centers, or be friends with any person that has parental responsibility. He's described as Indigenous, 5 feet 8 inches tall, 200 pounds, with a stocky build, light brown hair and eyes. Police say people who are at risk include female and male children and teenagers, including acquaintances and the general public. VPD is asking anyone who sees him violating his conditions to call 911 immediately. Mira Baines, CBC News, Vancouver.
Port Coquitlam Mayor Greg Moore has decided not to seek re-election next November. Moore has been mayor of Port Coquitlam for 10 years and says it just feels like the right time to step down. Before the next election, though, he says there is still a lot he wants to accomplish.
We're doing a downtown action plan to get more development. We've got some great transit initiatives that we're working on. We're building a new rec center. Still a lot to do, and I'm excited about the next 10 months and finishing strong.
His advice for anyone looking to take over his seat, consult your loved ones. He says the support from his family has been key to his success. The family of Ella Hernandez, one of two girls killed in the crash in Coquitlam back in May, is looking to leave a legacy in her name. They're pushing the city of Coquitlam to commit to making the roads safer. Stephen Brunel speaks for Ella's parents, Michelle and Gary.
They would like, one, the city and the mayor to say publicly, we will do everything we can to make this road safer. And secondly, if they would announce that at a council meeting or something so it's on the public record. So Michelle and Gary know that they are trying to do something.
But Brunel says the city won't meet with the family because there's a lawsuit regarding the crash. The family argues the lawsuit has nothing to do with improving road safety in Coquitlam. Indigenous people from around the Okanagan gathered yesterday for the unveiling of a monument recognizing the trauma suffered by residential school survivors. As Brady Strachan reports, the monument is located at a spot where children were once loaded onto cattle trucks and taken away from their families.
Once a place of tragedy, this site is now a spot of healing and recognition. A metal sculpture of two Indigenous parents welcoming their children into their arms was unveiled yesterday. Elder Jack Kruger is a residential school survivor.
I think it's important for people to know the story because never again would I ever like to see this happen to anybody else.
Kruger says at this spot, children were put on cattle trucks and taken off to a residential school. It
took a whole day to go from here to Kamloops, for instance. And to go to bathroom, they had to go to bathroom on themselves. It was very traumatizing. Even some kids just fell in the manure and they just didn't have any energy to get up.
Kruger says he's still recovering from his experience, but he's hopeful for the children of his community who he says have a bright future ahead of them. Brady Strachan, CBC News on the Penticton Indian Band.
The Wildlife Rescue Association of BC says bird injuries are on the rise, and it says it could be the result of the wildfires this past summer. The organization, which is based in Burnaby, says there has been a 66% increase in the number of injured songbirds during the fall migration. Wendy Easton is a bird biologist with the Canadian Wildlife Service. She says songbird trackers in the Chilcotin, which was devastated by wildfires, have caught and tagged half the number of birds they normally would.
birds do have some flexibility in their migration routes and in their timing, so it could be that birds headed either sooner or towards the coast and tried to avoid other areas of the province.
The Orphaned Wildlife Rehabilitation Society in Delta says the number of injured birds it has seen has already surpassed last year's total. And in other news, allegations of inappropriate sexual behavior have resulted in another high-profile dismissal. NBC has announced it has terminated longtime Today Show host Matt Lauer. Lauer's co-anchor, Savannah Guthrie, made the announcement at the start of this morning's broadcast. She read a statement from NBC News chairman Andy Lack, who said the company has received a detailed complaint from a colleague of Lauer's on Monday night. Lack said in his statement that it was the first complaint about Lauer in more than 20 years at NBC, but that the broadcaster had reason to believe it might not have been an isolated incident. It's approaching 5:36. That's the CBC News.
Thank you, Drew. Amy.
Yeah, it's already off to a busy start. We have a couple of problems in or just outside of Agassiz, east of Agassiz, at the low heat of Highway 7 down to a single alternating lane because of an earlier collision. So they're hoping to have everything reopened between 8 and 10. So that'll put a little bit of a extra delay in people's morning commute. Also in Abbotsford right now, Bradner Road closed between Fraser Highway and Simpson Road. Some power lines were brought down in an overnight collision, so they're going to have to get those fixed up before they can let traffic through there. So we'll keep you posted on that. Nothing else to pass along. We're just going to see the volume building steadily and quite quickly for some of the major routes. So Alex Fraser already getting a bit slower. See more vehicles heading towards the Patello Bridge and the Pitt River Bridge, and they'll have the counterflow lane in the next 15 minutes or so at the Massey Tunnel. Starting off dry, we've had a few showers, but the main event arrives later. So we'll see the clouds increasing this morning and then periods of rain come in by the afternoon. Windy near the water and a high of 9 degrees. Heavy rain overnight at 20 to 30 millimeters, especially heavy near the North Shore Mountains, dropping down to 6 degrees. And then that rain will taper to showers tomorrow afternoon and more rain arrives for Friday, Saturday. But then Sunday, we dry out and get a nice mix of sun and cloud. And I'll be back with more traffic and weather in about 10 minutes.
Thanks, Amy. 23 minutes before 6 o'clock and still to come. A Kamloops woman takes her first steps on the road to recovery from drug addiction. We'll have more on that in just a couple of moments. But first, off to the sports desk, where this morning we say hello there to Matt Cullen.
Good morning. Lots of hockey last night, including the Vancouver Canucks in Brooklyn. And the slide continues, a 5-2 loss to the New York Islanders. The New York area has not been kind to the Canucks. Losses earlier to the New Jersey Devils and the Rangers, and now it's the Islanders. Busy night in the NHL. Toronto Maple Leafs are coming to town on Saturday, and they will be tough. And that's because they celebrated another win last night against the Calgary Flames. 4-1, Toronto has won 8 of its last 11. To soccer, and as painful as it may be for Vancouver soccer fans, but the city of Toronto is one win away from another championship game. After a Grey Cup parade following the Argonauts' thrilling victory, it's a big day for Toronto FC playing the second leg of the MLS Eastern Conference Final against Columbus. A 0-0 draw in the opening leg, and that was without stars Sebastian Giovinco and Josie Altidore due to suspension for Toronto. And the dynamic duo will be back. A win would put Toronto FC back in the final for the second straight year. Familiar name in golf is set to give it another go. We'll talk about Tiger Woods coming up. He's feeling fantastic ahead of the Hero World Challenge. Says he's done using his golf club as a walking stick. We'll hear from him, and lots more coming up on sports throughout the morning.
All right, thank you, Matt. And Matt will be back with a full sports update for us right after the 6:30 news, about an hour from now. It's 21 minutes before 6 o'clock. Well, after 6 months of living outdoors, a Kamloops woman has decided now is the time to get off the streets. She met up with the CBC's Doug Herbert yesterday while he was working on a story about outreach workers. They routinely visit parks to clean up discarded needles, to support drug users with harm reduction and other programs, and occasionally someone reaches out for help. And that's what happened yesterday.
Where have you been? You guys have naloxone on you?
Yes.
I have it.
Yeah. Do you want a naloxone kit?
Yes, please.
Yeah, a couple. Yeah. Do you guys need any HR gear?
No.
No? Harm reduction, needle kit. You know what I have cooking right now over in shop? Bacon and eggs.
Oh my God.
You come with me, sister.
You good?
I'm going for bacon and eggs. Yep.
Do you guys have any needles?
Welcome to our day.
I'm Crystal Maddie.
I live usually on the beach in a hole, in a tent and in a hole.
Describe it for me. What does it look like?
Okay, one of my close friends, she dug a hole that is probably about 7 feet deep, and it has a little seating bench and a couple stairs so you can get in. You actually have to go into the ground to get into it. She built a roof out of logs and tarps.
Mm-hmm. And you've got a tent there.
I did have. Bylaw took my tent.
So now she's just sleeping in a hole.
Yeah.
So do you have any blankets or?
Yeah, I have a couple.
You're getting out of there.
I am getting out of there.
And you're making big moves. Right?
I am getting out, and I am making big moves. I am going to get help so I can help other people.
Mm-hmm. What are you doing tomorrow?
I'm going on Suboxone.
Yes. Yay! That's awesome news. And today we're working on trying to get you out of a hole.
Yes.
And into a hotel room.
Yes.
With a kitchen.
Yes.
Yes. So that's the plan for today. Kira Hogue, Ask Wellness.
So that's part of the work that you do here.
Yeah, yeah. Those are some of the wraparound services. So, you know, like Carly, whoever's here, or even the shop team downstairs. So there's a bunch of us that provide outreach services, and it's, you know, connecting people to mental health, chronic health supports, finding out where meals are available each day, getting people out of holes, finding them hotel rooms, getting them their damage deposit with the ministry, and getting them on income assistance. If they want to be on Suboxone or Methadose, then we support them through those efforts. But it's more than, you know, needle pickup and naloxoning people. It's really trying to bring about positive outcomes.
How long have you been using?
2 years.
2 years. And how long you've been in sort of living in by the river?
Or? No, I actually just started living by the river. I've been on the streets for about a year, started living outside probably about 6 months ago.
And what made you decide that you needed help?
I actually saw a close friend of mine OD. Luckily he's okay today, but he wasn't at the time. He actually did, we had to Narcan him several times and give him CPR. And I want better, and I want to be able to provide my kids with better and help other people.
And you have kids?
I do.
How many?
I have two girls.
Two girls. How old?
13 and 8.
13 and 8. And you still see them regularly, or?
Yes, when I'm not using.
What would you tell people in Kamloops that have never talked to somebody that lives on the street?
Everybody has their own stories. Come to ask and speak to them. I never thought that I'd be able to come here and talk to anybody. I didn't think I'd be able to trust anybody. And I've made some very close connections with these ladies, and I feel very blessed to have them because they aren't judgmental, and everybody has a story. Everybody has a past, and everybody needs somebody. And these ladies are here to help, and that's what people need to know, and that just don't judge everybody just because of them being homeless or drug addicts. Not everybody's a bad person. They do bad things, not bad people.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for speaking with me this morning, and good luck.
Thank you.
That was Crystal Maddy of Kamloops speaking with our Doug Herbert, who met her yesterday just as she made that decision to change your life and get off the streets. 16 minutes now before 6 o'clock. Well, Friday, day after tomorrow, marks our 31st annual CBC Open House and Food Bank Day, and you're invited to come down to the CBC for a special broadcast as we raise money for food banks right across the province all day long. You know there's 100 food banks in operation here in BC? And joining us on the early edition will be our house band, the Sojourners, along with a special guest this year, Jill Barber. Here's Jill now with a song called This Christmas.
The snow falls lightly on the ground. Covers the fallen leaves still hanging around. early to come home this Christmas. Oh, to see our tree in all of the glory. Decorations made by hand that tell our family story. As an angel surely watches from on high. Echoing a quiet hymn. Oh, the season is before us. Let us raise a glass and sing. If I were to pray this Christmas, it would be to find open our hearts and open our doors. And I would wish a Merry Christmas to you and yours. Merry Christmas to you and yours.
There you go. From her album, A New Kind of Light, that's Jill Barber with This Christmas. And Jill will be part of our special music presentation on the early edition this Friday. So come on down for our 31st annual Open House and Food Bank Day here at the CBC at 700 Hamilton Street. We've got the Sojourners, Carleone, Jill Barber. It's going to be loads of fun. We've got 11 minutes to go now before 6 o'clock. And Polly Legere joins us here in Studio 10, our studio director, along with Tanya Fletcher from our CBC Vancouver newsroom and cbc.ca/BC. Hello, you too.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Tanya, what's shaking out there in the newsroom this morning?
Well, Stats Canada is out with its latest round of census data released exactly 18 minutes ago, and the numbers show more than half of Canada's core working population have earned post-secondary degrees or diplomas, and that's the highest rate among OECD countries, including the States, by the way. So besides education and employment, it's also providing a snapshot on commuting patterns. So we're going to be teasing out some data from each of the municipalities around the Lower Mainland, and specifically looking at numbers between 2011 and 2016, comparing modes of transportation as well as the time it takes a typical commuter to get to work.
Okay. Polly, a story that continues to roll along, and this is this long-standing legal battle over Trinity Western University's law school and at least two law societies in this country that refuse to accredit any graduates from this school. And now it's going to the highest court, and it's going to be argued tomorrow in front of the Supreme Court.
Yeah, so the Supreme Court of Canada is going to hear two appeal cases involving the faith-based university. They, as you know, so they want to have a law school. And one's being brought forward by the Law Society of BC, which is challenging a BC Court of Appeal, their decision in favor of Trinity Western University. And the other appeal is being brought forward by Trinity Western University against an Ontario Court of Appeal decision against the university. It sounds muddied, but that's because this is a very sprawling case. This dates back to 2014 when several law societies, including BC's, refused to give the university's law grads accreditation. And their arguments hinge on the concerns that the school's community covenant discriminates against LGBTQ people. So we're going to hear from the head of the proposed law school about why it's still pushing for a faith-based school, and that is at 7:10.
All right. And Tanya, what are folks reading online?
Well, far and away, the most clicked on story on our website, surprise, surprise, has to do with property sales. A Richmond farm has sold for more than 100 times its assessed value. So it's an 8-hectare property on Blundell Road. It was assessed at $84,000 for 2017. But last month, it sold for $9.2 million. Now, it struck an angry chord with at least one city councillor there. He points out farmland is assessed at a lower rate to benefit farmers. And Harold Stee says the purchase opens up a new potential development site because, in his mind, nobody is buying that land to farm it. So you can see it for yourself at cbc.ca/BC.
And finally, Polly, the Whistler Film Festival opens tonight with a number of luminaries. Among them, a prominent Hollywood producer will be there.
Yeah. So Susan Cartsonis is behind movies like What Women Want, and she's taking this opportunity at the film festival to talk about how the film industry treats women. So this is particularly poignant in the wake of the Harvey Weinstein scandal. And Cartsonis thinks that the film industry needs to work harder at gender parity. She says this current imbalance is perpetuating a pervasive culture of sexism and abuse in the industry. And so we'll hear from her at 6:50.
All right. That's Polly Legere, our studio director, and of course, Tanya Fletcher from our CBC Vancouver newsroom and cbc.ca/BC. And those stories coming up this morning here on the Early Edition. Here's Amy Bell.
Yeah, just busier out there for all the major routes. So you'll see things getting a little sluggish for the Alex Fraser, the Patello Bridge off King George, Counterflow Lane in at the Massey Tunnel, and things look great on Highway 99. We do have two problems. Just east of Agassiz, Lougheed Highway 7 down to single lane alternating traffic after an earlier collision. So they're hoping to have all lanes reopened between 8 and 10. They're going to keep us updated. And then in Abbotsford, Bradner Road, sounds like it's closed between Fraser Highway and Simpson due to some power lines that came down. I'd love an update, though, if any traffic is able to get through at star pound 690. Not too bad to start. We'll see increasing clouds. We've got some foggy patches. And then we will see periods of rain or showers late today. Heavy rain overnight. And then that rain does taper off to showers by tomorrow afternoon. But more rainfall for Friday. Back with more traffic and weather before the news.
So the Grammy nominations are out.
Yep.
Canada punching above its weight again. Lots of nominations.
Yeah, we're doing great.
Justin Bieber, Alicia Cara, Michael Bublé, among some of the Canadians who will be are nominated, but not Drake.
Scandalous.
Well, the Canadian hip-hop star reportedly did not submit his latest album, More Life, for consideration. And for more on Drake and the Grammys and the feud that exists now, on the line is Del Cowie, who is a freelance music journalist. He's in our Toronto studios. Del, good morning.
Good morning, Rick.
Drake has taken this issue in the past with the way the Grammys have treated rap music and rap artists. What's behind this now? What's going on here?
Okay, yeah. Well, to talk about Drake's music specifically, I'm not, like I said, I'm not exactly sure when it comes to specifically his reasoning around More Life. But last year, Hotline Bling did win two awards. And as a lot of people know, that song was everywhere.
Yeah.
And it's not a rap song, though.
But no.
But the song won in rap categories. And I think he kind of took some issue with that. He basically did verbalize that in a couple of interviews, saying, you know, why is it categorized here? It's not a rap song. And you know, there were various singers of various genres covering the record, and they weren't rapping either when they were doing their performances of it. So, yeah, I mean, I think that's part of where his issues are coming with it.
Yeah, he says, I'm not a rap artist. I'm a musician. And if you listen to his music, it's hard to call it rap. Hip-hop, maybe, but pop music generally. So what do the Grammys say in response?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think he does. I mean, he definitely does do rap music as well, but I think he's very multifaceted. That particular song definitely wasn't a rap song, though. And yeah, I mean, I think when it comes to the Grammys themselves, I think he was just trying to make a point, because I think overall there has been a history of hip hop being kind of misrepresented at the Grammys. And in terms of its popularity, for sure. The last rap album to actually win Album of the Year happened in 2004, and that was for Outkast. And before that was Lauryn Hill. And those are the only two winners in the history of the Grammys, or hip-hop artists winning the Album of the Year award.
Yeah, this isn't the first time the Grammys have been criticized for being, hate to say it, but out of touch with pop culture. What's the Grammys record like on this front?
Yeah, well, again, like I was saying, it's not great when it comes to reflecting those things. They've been criticized in the past for things like giving awards to, I think there was the year when Beck won Album of the Year, when people thought Beyonce should have won, the year that Steely Dan won, when people thought Eminem should have won. You know, these things have come up every few years, and it's not only, you know, like I just mentioned with Outkast and Lauryn Hill. Those are issues too. And, you know, the fact is that hip hop has been seen, it's been widely reported now as the most listened to music genre. And, you know, it's just, it feels a little out of touch when, you know, this is what a lot of people are listening to, but then it's not necessarily reflected in the people who are winning and getting nominated in the major categories that the Grammys presents.
How obvious will Drake's absence be?
Well, Drake is actually, yeah, I hear what you're saying in terms of absence, but his absence is actually, he's still there, present in a lot of ways. I'll say this because of the fact that what's happened is that him and the objections that him and other artists have been making have actually, you know, propelled the Grammys to make some changes, it seems, behind the scenes. So I think this year what happened was is that online voting was implemented. For a lot of musicians, they're on the road a lot, and that's just more convenient for them. And then what has happened is that you have a better reflection of what is actually going on in the industry. And I think you're seeing with the nominees that came out yesterday a better reflection of what people are actually listening to, and a better reflection of what, you know, the best music is.
Del, a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Del Cowie, freelance music journalist in our Toronto studios. We got 2 minutes to go now before 6 o'clock, and Drew's back with some local news headlines for us.
Rick, a 10-year veteran of civic politics in Metro Vancouver, is calling it quits. Port Coquitlam Mayor Greg Moore says he will not seek re-election next year. Vancouver police have issued a warning about a man with a history of sexual offenses. They say Christian Otto Olsen has been released into a halfway house, and they believe he poses a significant risk to re-offend. And the family of two girls killed in a crash in Coquitlam this past spring are asking the city of Coquitlam to make roads there safer. But a family spokesperson says the city won't meet with them because the crash is now the subject of a lawsuit. More local news coming up in half an hour. Now here's Amy Bell with an update on the roads.
We have a new problem. It's just north of the Massey Tunnel. So northbound Highway 99 at that Steveston off-ramp. So the right lane is blocked. They had just gotten the counterflow lane in, but it is starting to back up. So expect a few delays, hopefully out of the way very soon. We have the low heat, Highway 7 down to single lane alternating just east of Agassiz after an earlier collision. And in Abbotsford, Bradner Road still shut down between Fraser Highway and Simpson. Some power lines came down in an overnight collision, so they're working to get everything back up and running through there. It is getting busier for the Alex Fraser and the Patello bridges. Also seeing more delays for the Pitt River Bridge, but Highway 1 still moving well out of Abbotsford through into Langley and then again through Burnaby Lake. And we are seeing increasing clouds this morning. Could see some showers and then a bit of heavier rain late today. Windy, high of 9. The rain continues overnight. We'll see about 20 to 30 millimeters, and then we'll see rain again to start tomorrow. Yay.
'Tis the season.
Sure is.
It's 6 o'clock. World Report is up next here on CBC Radio 1. Good morning. I'm Rick Clough. This is the Early Edition. It's Wednesday, the 29th day of November. And we'll get a little bit of everything lined up for you in the weather. Amy Bell's going to be here with weather and traffic in just a couple of moments. Our top story this half hour, should doctors test brain function before operating on elderly patients? House Dr. Peter Lynn makes that case. That's coming up. But first, Drew Karakas is here with headlines from our CBC Vancouver newsroom.
Rick, Vancouver police have issued a warning about a man with a lengthy criminal record who is now living in a halfway house in the city. The mayor of Port Coquitlam says he's not sure what the future holds, but Greg Moore has decided 10 years in politics is enough. And a health authority in northern BC says it's looking at ways to help pregnant women in Fort Nelson who have to travel hundreds of kilometres away from home in order to give birth. More local news coming up at 6:30. Now over to Amy Bell with traffic and weather.
We have a few problems on the go. A new crash now westbound just off the west end of the Port Man as you're coming into the Cape Horn. That has the left lane blocked. And now we have two separate problems on Highway 99 northbound, both north of the Massey Tunnel at Steveston. So that has the right and left lanes blocked. Camflo Lane is in, but it is getting busier. In Abbotsford, Bradner Road closed from Simpson to Fraser Highway. They're working to fix some power lines that came down in an overnight crash. And then also an overnight crash has Highway 7 down to single lane alternating traffic just east of Agassiz until further notice. We will see increasing clouds throughout the morning, seeing a few foggy spots as well. We will see periods of rain and showers late in the day. The winds will pick up off the water and we'll get up to a high of 9 degrees. And then the rain really hits us tonight, 20 to 30 millimeters. Windy, low down to 6. Starting off a bit stormier tomorrow, but then things settling down in the afternoon to just showers and then rain for Friday and Saturday. However, we'll see a mix of sun and cloud on Sunday.
Yay!
It'll be lovely. Back with more in about 10 minutes.
Thanks, Amy. Now 12 minutes past 6 o'clock here on the early edition on CBC Radio 1. A recent study recommends that doctors should check the brain function of older surgery patients before putting them through any surgery. Researchers found many patients over the age of 65 might have undiagnosed impairments, which could result in severe complications post-surgery. Now, for more on this, on the line is our house doctor, Dr. Peter Lynn. Hello there.
Hey, Rick.
So, why are these researchers saying doctors should do a cognitive test before clearing older patients for surgery?
Yeah, it's interesting. So this is a Harvard group, and they've been noticing that they're doing a lot of surgeries on people over the age of 65.
Yeah.
And some of them do really well, and then some of them just end up in a mess, right? So in other words, they get delirium, which is a condition where they get confused right after the surgery. Their brain doesn't work well. They can't think straight. They can't function. Sometimes they don't even know their loved ones. And so, which means that they're going to stay in hospital for longer and they have more complications from the surgery. So the idea is, can we pick out these people ahead of time before their surgery? And their comment is that, you know, we check your kidneys, we check your heart before we send you to first surgery. So now they're saying that we should check your brain function as well.
So it's the anesthetic that has an effect on their brains?
Yeah. So they're trying to figure out, is it anesthetic? Is it all these the type of surgeries, so bypass surgeries and things like that, where we affect the blood flow to your head is a higher risk and things like that. So they actually looked at 211 patients going for different types of surgeries over the age of 65, and they did a little screening test on them called a mini-cog test. And basically, it's scored out of 5. And if they score less than 2 out of 5, they notice those are the people that got into trouble. 37% longer stays in hospital, 4.5 times more likely to wake up confused after the surgery, and 4 times more likely to end up not at home. In other words, they have to go through nursing home care or rehab or something like that before they can look after themselves. And then about 25% of them actually had dementia that they didn't know about when they screened them in this fashion. So it's an easy way to pick out people at high risk.
You mentioned a mini cog test. What exactly is that?
Yeah, so it's short form for mini cognitive testing. In medicine, we're kind of constantly shrinking things down. We have lots of different tests to look at your memory, but a lot of them are complicated. So this is sort of the quick and dirty way of doing it. It takes about 2 minutes to do. And so what you do is you ask the patient, you know, remember these three words. So ball, cat, tree, and you get them to say it back to you to make sure that they've registered those words. And then what you do is you tell them, I'm going to ask you back in a few minutes to tell me those words. And then you get them to do a clock draw. And basically what you do is you say, draw me a clock that shows 10 after 11. And so 10 after 11, that's kind of an abstract kind of concept, right? So people with Alzheimer's disease or dementia, they're very concrete. They're going to hear the word 10 and 11. So they start pointing the, you know, the hands at those numbers along the way. And the clock draw, even though it's so simple, it actually tests a whole bunch of things at the same time, right? Can you plan the circle? Can you draw the circle? Can you do the visual spatial thing? Where do the numbers fit? The long hand, the short hand, and this abstract thinking, what does 10 after 11 can really mean. So you're actually testing a whole bunch of different parts of your brain at the same time. Once they finish doing that, then you basically say, okay, what were the three words? And then if they get 0 out of 3, so none of the words, then they're more likely to have dementia. If they get all three right, then they're less likely to have dementia. Now, what happens if you're in the middle, you get 1 or 2 right, then we use the clock. If the clock is normal, you're probably okay. If the clock is abnormal, then we should worry. So it's a very simple tool that they use to sort of separate people that we need to pay attention to and that people that are good.
Ball cat tree.
There you go. I want to see your clock.
Why does something like undiagnosed dementia cause so many complications after surgery?
Yeah, so it turns out patients with dementia or Alzheimer's disease, when you look at their brain, they've actually had loss of brain cells. So there's less brain cells there. They've died. So it's kind of like, you know, muscles. You know, when we're young, we were very, you know, muscular. We can lift stuff and, you know, we'd be sore for a day, but we'd bounce right back. But nowadays I lift up something, I'm gone for 2 weeks, right? So basically there's no bouncing back. So the same thing happens with our dementia patients. They have less brain cells, so they have less flexibility, less reserves. So when we hit them with an anesthetic and we send them down into the cellar, so to speak, it takes them a long time to bounce back up. And the same thing with pain medications, because we're doing the same thing. We're hitting the brain cells and changing how they talk to each other. So again, it takes them longer to bounce back. And also, if you think about a hospital, it's not a very good place to sleep, right? So, you know, there's a lot of beeping noises from machines and the nurses have to come in and check you and make sure that your blood pressure is okay and things like that. So their sleep is disturbed as well. And we've sort of hit them with medication. So if they have already a weakened brain, like in dementia or Alzheimer's disease, then they're going to be more scrambled. And that's why we get the delirium.
Okay, let's say someone you determine suffers from dementia. Does that mean they don't qualify for the hip surgery? Because it's painful for them.
Yes.
Just as painful as for somebody without dementia.
Yeah, and so the thought is not to withdraw the surgery, but to figure out what can we do to make sure that they don't spiral into this. So now we have a fast test. We can identify who's at risk. What do we do differently? So some people say, hey, let's make sure that the room is calm and quiet, so therefore we don't disturb their sleep. Some very smart people are saying, can we give them less anesthetic? And the way you do that is you monitor the brain function, and then what you do is you just give them enough anesthetic to put them under, but you don't snow them and send them into the basement.
How would epidurals and things like that?
Yeah, so we can do regional. So let's say it's just the knee, then we can do an epidural. We leave your brain alone. So those are all the things that they're thinking about. And also in terms of pain medication, can we give them enough pain medication to manage their pain but not snow them too much? Because sometimes we have these standing orders, give all this stuff, and, you know, regardless of whether the patient wants it. So now we have to sort of tailor make it. And they also said check those oxygen levels, you know, going up to the brain. So in other words, our pipes get clogged up as we get older. So are we getting enough nutrients to the brain? Can we send a bit of oxygen up there and help with the brain function as well? And then they said you need to know whether they're deaf or they're, you know, having problems with vision or they speak a different language ahead of time. Because imagine if they're deaf and you don't know it. Mm. So now you're giving them instructions, but they don't hear anything. So they don't do any of the important things. And if they don't speak the language, what happens? How do they tell you they're in pain? How do they tell you got to go to the bathroom? So knowing that information will be helpful. So doing this laundry list may be helpful, because then the patient doesn't turn a 2-day operation into like a 3-month nursing home stay. Because that's very traumatic for the patient, very traumatic for the family.
Sure.
And the cost to the system is incredible, right? It's supposed to be a 2-day operation. Now you've dragged it out to 3 months. So lots of good benefits, but that little test we can do outside surgery situation. So I've had patients where I got to send them home with blood thinners. So I do this test. Can they remember what I just told them? So we can make sure that they're taking their medication properly. Or is dad going to leave the stove on and burn the house down? You know, so you can use this test to not just check for a surgery risk, but also risk of living at home, that kind of thing. And if you have an abnormal clock, for example, no doctor will brush you off. But if you say dad's memory's not so good, we just say, he's 80 years old, right? But if you come in with an abnormal clock, everybody will pay attention. So very simple test. Find people at risk and let's protect them, whether it's for surgery or whether it's just for daily living purposes. It's a good, useful tool.
Yeah, anesthetics do take a toll, don't they?
They do. I went through, for my ankle fracture, I went through 3 surgeries. And afterwards, you wake up and I had problems finding words. So that's bad for a doctor, who can't find words.
I had surgery over the summer and I woke up and I do not like the taste of coffee anymore. I used to love coffee.
That's great. So now you can save money and you can buy me a Christmas gift.
Anyway, just weird, that's all.
It is.
Peter, always a pleasure. Thank you, sir.
Thanks, Rick.
Chat next week. Peter Lynn, our house doctor here at the Early Edition in our Toronto studios. Amy Bell, How are things? I know it's already very busy.
It is very busy. We have a new problem on Highway 1 westbound. It's just before 232nd in the left lane. So already seeing delays now as you're coming through Langley. And then further west, we had that collision just west of the Portman. It's off to the right shoulder and should be out of the way soon. Two separate collisions on Highway 99 northbound, both north of the Massey Tunnel near Steveston. One blocking the right, the other blocking the left lane. So the problem is it's still... It's building for the Massey Tunnel, but you come through the tunnel at quite a good speed, and then you come into these problems where traffic gets down to one lane. So please use extra caution. You could use the Alex Fraser, but it is also building. So busy this morning. We still have single lane alternating on Highway 7 just east of Agassiz from an overnight crash, and Bradner Road still closed from Fraser Highway to Simpson after some power lines were brought down. Not too bad to start this morning. We'll head into more wet weather later on today. The winds will pick up and heavy rain overnight and more rain to start tomorrow. I'll be back with more traffic and weather before the news.
Thanks, Amy. Now 21 minutes past 6 o'clock. Well, Prime Minister Trudeau says diversity is Canada's strength. The CBC's ad guy, Bruce Chambers, says now some brands are echoing that sentiment.
Used to be when brands wanted to appeal to Canadian consumers, they'd align themselves with core Canadian values like politeness, devotion to hockey, or passion for wide open spaces. But today, the new shorthand for Canadianness is diversity.
Canadians embrace diversity, embrace differences, and celebrate them.
It's much better when we're together, you know? It's best when we're together.
I took the subway in drag, and I had two people that came to me, and I got so scared, and they said, oh, can we take a picture? You look beautiful.
If you missed the last few seconds of this ad from October, you might have assumed it was a government ad. But the frequent shots of clubs and drinking culminated in the line, stay open, along with the Smirnoff Vodka logo. Here's how the CFL aligns itself with diversity.
We are a league as diverse as a country. A league of Jacksons and Kwangs, Elamimians and Messams, Moscas, Custises, Sinopolis, Chiguers, and Burrises. A league of Reeds, Rices, O'Shea's, and Owusuwanses. A league where what makes each of us different makes all of us stronger.
In this next ad, we see a little girl watching the city go by from her car window. She sees lots of diversity, including recent refugees, a girl going on a date with another girl, and a mother painting her little boy's fingernails.
I hear babies crying. I watch them grow. They'll learn much more than I'll ever know. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
We can all have the beautiful kind of world we want. We can all have the beautiful kind of home we want. IKEA, the beautiful possibilities.
At the end, prices are displayed on the furniture in the little girl's living room. As you can see, none of these marketers is celebrating diversity for diversity's sake. It's all about tying in the brand and selling the product. Here we see a young girl and her mother using shiny new appliances to cook a Syrian lunch to share with her classmates.
I would like them to try it because I have never done this before.
Tastes good.
I have told them a lot about my story, but I think instead of hearing it will be much better to feel it. The goal was to get closer to them by giving them food. And it worked. It worked a lot.
We then see behind every meal is an act of care and the Whirlpool logo. Also this year, Molson resurrected a two-year-old ad in response to Donald Trump's immigration policies. We see a beer fridge on a pedestrian mall that can only be opened when it hears six people say, I am Canadian.
Six.
You just
no way.
You guys know any other languages?
Je suis Canadien.
Yeah. 我是加拿大人.
Oh. Io sono canadese.
Finally, they get six languages and everyone gets a beer. Marketers are aware that Canada's stance on diversity makes us feel proud and unique in an increasingly insular world. By championing these feelings, marketers build a stronger bond with consumers, so we'll buy more of their products. For CBC Radio, I'm Bruce Chambers.
Thank you, Bruce. And Bruce Chambers, our ad guy, you can go to his website, which is simply theadguy.ca. That's theadguy.ca. If you want to subscribe to his podcast, you can do that. 25 minutes now past 6 o'clock. Time to chat business. David Blair joins us from the CBC Business Desk. Hello there.
Good morning.
A couple of big stories to talk about this morning. Let's start in the energy sector, where the energy regulator is intervening in one of the country's major pipeline projects. So what are we going to see with the company Kinder Morgan today?
Well, today, the National Energy Board holds a meeting over the company's expansion of the Trans Mountain Pipeline. Kinder Morgan asked the regulator to intervene in the company's dispute with Burnaby. The company says that its project is being blocked by the city, that it's not issuing the permits required to continue its construction. The city says it needs more information before it can issue the necessary permits. Trans Mountain Pipeline already exists, so it's already shipping Alberta's oil across the Rockies through Burnaby for export. But the expansion of this pipeline has become one of the, you know, the largest flashpoints for activists.
Certainly is in this community.
Well, that's it. You know, I mean, and it's like there's environmentalists, there are indigenous groups, and of course, local politicians as well. So obviously the concern about the impact over expanding the export of oil from the Port of Vancouver, as well as the transport across, you know, from Alberta.
Yep.
So go ahead.
No, I'm just saying, I'm agreeing with you. Yeah, following along here.
So you've got the two sides here battling it out. Kinder Morgan's case is kind of interesting in the timing because its competitor TransCanada is dealing with a massive leak at its Keystone pipeline in South Dakota that we talked about earlier this week. So the optics aren't very good for the company. And, you know, I mean, the opponents can just say, told you so. And so the company wants a federal order to compel Burnaby to issue these required permits. We'll see how this all unfolds as the hearings get underway this afternoon.
Yeah, it is a very contentious issue in this community.
You bet.
Now, we saw one bank report earnings yesterday. Today, we're going to see Canada's largest bank, RBC, is reporting its earnings, and what is it going to say?
Well, it has come out with those earnings this morning, and it is a landmark in Canadian corporate history. For the first time, a Canadian bank has made over $11 billion in 1 year.
That's profit.
That is profit.
That's profit. That's not measuring their assets, their revenue stream. No. That's, hey, look what we made this year.
That's right.
$11 billion.
You can stuff that in your pocket.
Well, yeah. Your pocket's about the size of Manitoba.
But so the earnings report comes out this morning. Royal Bank hits a fresh annual record income of $11.5 billion. That's up $1 billion from 2016. Remember, we're talking billions here. Great news for investors. I mean, annual earnings are up 10% from last year. The previous quarter, RBC surprised investors with a dividend hike that was twice as much as analysts were expecting. The stock price has jumped over 10% in the past year. And RBC's chief executive, David McKay, says the earnings represent, quote, robust growth.
Really?
I think that's fair to say.
Yeah, I think that's pretty, it's an understatement of anything.
Yeah. So if you break it down, RBC's annual profit, every single week of the past year, the company made about $221 million profit per week. If there's some not so good news, as Barclay Capital put it in the third quarter release set of RBC's earnings, they said that the retail banking put in, quote, impressive performance. Retail banking is the money that RBC makes from you, from your credit cards, your consumer loans, your lines of credit, and those bank fees. So if you are an RBC customer, you are contributing part of your paycheck to help Royal Bank make more profit than any other company in Canadian history. Looks like the money business is a great way for Canadian banks to make lots of money.
Mm-hmm. Crazy. All right, sir. Yeah,
it's amazing.
After a while, I get confused by all those zeros.
Yeah, it's a big number, you know, but, you know, and if you look at it from the consumer standpoint, it's one thing. If you look at it from the investment standpoint, it's completely another, but it is what it is. And those are pretty impressive numbers.
They are indeed. Thank you, sir. We'll talk about the markets next hour.
Thank you.
David Blair at the CBC Business Desk, and here's Amy.
Getting very busy now at the Massey Tunnel. You're slowing between Highway 17 and 17A to get into the Massey Tunnel. We have those two separate crashes just north of the Massey Tunnel. So a lot of people heading for the Alex Fraser, and it's picking up a lot of extra volume. We will have rain later today, and I'll have all the details after the news.
And with the 6:30 news, here's Drew Karakas.
Good morning. It's 2 degrees and mostly cloudy in Vancouver. It has been 7 months since a car crash that killed three people in Coquitlam, including two children. Now the parents of one of the victims is urging the city of Coquitlam to make a commitment to improving road safety. Megan Batchelor reports.
9-year-old Ella Hernandez was killed when she was riding in a vehicle involved in a collision on the Lougheed Highway in April. Her 3-year-old cousin also killed. Now her parents want the city of Coquitlam to agree to make the roads there safer. Stephen Brunel speaks for the family.
Even though this obviously won't bring Ella back, their focus is on how can they make sure, if they can, that this doesn't happen to another family in the future.
After repeated requests to the city and mayor for a meeting, they've been turned down. The city of Coquitlam says it won't do interviews on the matter or meet with the family as the collision is tied up in a lawsuit. Brunel says that's not a valid reason.
Whether they make a commitment to safety or not won't impact any lawsuit. This is a completely separate issue.
They're hoping the commitment would create a legacy of safety in Ella's name. Megan Batchelor, CBC News, Vancouver.
The mayor of Port Coquitlam says he doesn't know what's in store for the future, but his days in politics are coming to an end. Greg Moore says he won't be seeking re-election next year. He has served as mayor of Port Coquitlam for 10 years and says it just feels like the right time to step down. Moore says he'll remain in office until the next civic election and says there's still a lot he hopes to accomplish, including the Downtown Action Plan and building a new rec center. He says he has no plans to run either federally or provincially. Vancouver police have issued a warning about a convicted sex offender who has been released from custody and is now living in a halfway house in the city. Investigators believe Christian Otto Olsen poses a significant risk of reoffending. He has previously been convicted of sexual assault, child pornography, and sexual interference and touching. There are several restrictions on his release. He's been ordered to wear an electronic monitoring device, and he is forbidden to be near places where children congregate, such as schools, parks, and recreation centers. Police say Olsen is a potential threat to female and male children and teenagers. There's a picture of him on our website, cbc.ca/bc. Northern Health says it's exploring ideas to help women in Fort Nelson who can't afford to give birth hundreds of kilometers away from home. As Audrey McKinnon reports, there have been no maternity services in that community for 5 years.
Pregnant women in Fort Nelson are told to sign a contract with their doctor. It says it's not safe to deliver their babies in the community. They have to travel nearly 400 kilometers away at least. It's been this way since 2012 when the local maternity ward was closed permanently because of a doctor shortage. Angela DeSmit is the Northeast Chief Operating Officer for Northern Health.
Our biggest commitment is to ensure patient safety comes first.
Maternity services were often canceled several years before the permanent closure already. DeSmit says the health authority is still in conversation with stakeholders about how they can help women who can't afford the trip.
We're continuing to have those conversations about what that would look like, you know, where the funding would come from, who would offer it.
DeSmit says women can use the Northern Health Connections bus, which costs $20 or $40 for people in Fort Nelson, but there is no support in place for accommodations while women are staying out of town. Audrey McKinnon, CBC News, Prince George.
The City of Trail officially opens its new airport today. City officials will cut the ribbon on a $9 million facility complete with a newly paved runway. Pacific Coastal has flights between Vancouver and Trail, and Mayor Mike Martin says this will make the experience more comfortable.
It's about 4,000 square feet with all the amenities of a modern terminal servicing an airport of our size.
Trail's old airport was a building leased from the local flying club. And there's some unusual activity going on at the Wildlife Rescue Association of BC in Burnaby. As Corey Correa explains, it says it could be the result of wildfires this past summer.
Since August, the Wildlife Rescue Association has taken in 664 injured songbirds. That's 66% more than it took in last year during the fall migration. The rescue center also took in an injured white-winged crossbill, the first one in 10 years. Staff say something is markedly different than previous years, and nothing stands out more than BC's summer wildfires. Wendy Easton is a land bird biologist with the Canadian Wildlife Service. She says the service's songbird tracking in the Chilcotin, which was hit by wildfires this summer, saw far fewer birds this year.
Having the fires at the scale that we did and the extent that we did this year in British Columbia, we are likely to see some decreases or increases in bird numbers because of that.
Easton says the changing migration of songbirds, who help our ecosystem with pollination and pest control, could be the canary in the coal mine. But she says data is still coming in, so the jury is out on what this means for bird populations. Corey Correa, CBC News, Burnaby.
It's 6:35, and that's the CBC News.
Thank you kindly, sir. Amy.
Yeah, it's a busy morning, unfortunately. A lot of trouble at the Massey Tunnel, so I think at this point you should just steer clear for a little bit. We have two separate collisions northbound at the north end, so it's already lining up well before the 17A, pushing it towards the Delta Works Yard. However, now getting reports that there's a collision in the only southbound lane, so nothing getting through there. I would love an update. Thank you so much to everybody that has been calling in to keep me posted. But yeah, a lot of people are heading for the Alex Fraser now, so we're seeing more volume on the Alex Fraser. Keep that in mind. Just give yourself extra time to get to where you're going. Have a crash on Highway 1 westbound just before 232nd. That is in the left lane. Cleared the collision, though, that was off the west end of the Portman, but we are seeing a lot of volume and a lot more through Burnaby Lake. On Highway 7, just east of Agassiz, single lane alternating still from an earlier collision. And in Abbotsford, Bradner Road still closed between Fraser Highway and Simpson while they fix up some hydro wires that were brought down in a collision. Now for the weather, we're going to see increasing cloud today, some rain or showers later on. The winds will pick up. We'll see a high of 9. Stormy overnight, though. Rain about 20 to 30 millimeters. Winds really gusting off the water and a low down to 6. But then things settling down again. We'll start off really wet tomorrow, but then start to dry out in the afternoon before we get back into rain for Friday. And I will be back with more in about 10 minutes.
Thanks, Amy. Still to come this half hour, an Indigenous women's group is worried a proposed Kinder Morgan camp for workers could put women in their community in some danger. We'll have more on that in just a couple of moments, but right now it's off to the sports desk and Matt Cullen.
Good morning, Rick. Tough night for the Vancouver Canucks last night. 5-2 loss to the New York Islanders. Head coach Travis Green playing the tired card. It was the fifth game of the six-game road trip for the Canucks. Thomas Vanek, Bo Horvat got the Vancouver goals. And what's funny about this road trip here, Rick, is that Vancouver got off to a pretty good start in the first two, winning them both. But the last three have been a different story. Here's Bo Horvat, on the road trip.
Yeah, it's frustrating. I mean, obviously, you know, you're getting off, you're starting on a high, winning the first two, and then, you know, you just don't get the right bounces, and you don't, you know, you're not playing the way you have to be playing the last three games, and, you know, it's, it hurts in the standings, because, I mean, you know, the division's so tight, and you know, we need all the wins we can get.
So what was a good start to the season is now three straight losses and seven losses in the last 10 games. So the Canucks hope to turn that around. Busy night in the NHL elsewhere, a battle of Canadian teams in Alberta. Maple Leafs were in Calgary taking on the Flames. Maple Leafs have won 8 of 11 games now, 4-1 win last night over the Calgary Flames, and they'll be in town on Saturday to face the Canucks, and they're playing some good hockey now. I grew up in the Vancouver area, actually, and always enjoyed watching the Maple Leafs and the Canucks. Always a good rivalry between those two fan groups, but
always
you bet the Leafs will be a little louder now.
Always seems when the Leafs play here, though, there's more Toronto jerseys in the crowd than Canucks jerseys. But that's pretty true, I guess, wherever they go.
That's true, yeah.
They're so
well, they're playing some good hockey, so we're noticing them now.
They're playing good hockey, but it's I guess because it's, you know, one of the original six, and long before the Canucks were even born, people were Leaf fans.
There you go. Also, another Toronto team doing quite well. The City of Toronto, one win away from another championship game after an exciting Grey Cup parade yesterday at City Hall. Now the attention turns to the pitch. Toronto FC playing the second leg of the MLS Eastern Conference Final against Columbus. The two played to a 0-0 draw the first leg in Columbus. That was without Sebastian Giovinco and Josie Altidore, though, for Toronto, two stars. So the dynamic duo will be back in the lineup for the Reds tonight. An outright win for TFC would get them to the championship game for the second straight year. And finally, Rick, want to bring up some golf. A bit weird bringing up golf maybe in late November, but Tiger Woods is making another return, or he's trying to anyway. 41 years old, the former number one says he's feeling quote-unquote fantastic. So what's the most exciting part for Tiger Woods here? Let's take a listen.
The neatest thing for me is to be able to get up out of bed and I can grab a club and not use it as a crutch. Okay? So now I'll be able to take a swing. That's so exciting. You have no idea how exciting that is.
Anytime you use a golf club as a crutch, that's usually not a good sign.
That's true. But boy, he's been through a number of back surgeries, so we wish him well this time.
Yeah, absolutely. So he's back on the course. That's starting tomorrow in the Bahamas, the Hero World Challenge. So he's tried to come back a couple of times. He's had some troubles. He had some legal difficulties as well over the last couple of years. But he's saying he's pain-free for the first time in 2 years. So we'll keep an eye on that.
All right. Thank you, Matt.
Thank you.
Matt Cullen at the National Sports Desk. He'll be back an hour from now with a further sports update for us. It's 19 minutes before 7 o'clock. A group against the Trans Mountain Pipeline Project is issuing a women's declarations against Kinder Morgan work camps. Now, they say the company is proposing to build a 1,000-worker camp in the territory of the Sequipnuk First Nations near Kamloops. And the group says it's worried about violence against women if that camp is built. So they plan to deliver the declaration straight to the president and CEO of Kinder Morgan, Ian Anderson. Now, for more on this, on the line is Kanahus Manuel, who is a Sequipnuk Women's Warrior with the Women's Warrior Society and joins us on the line. Kanahus, good morning.
Good morning.
Why is your group worried about the safety of women in your community if Kinder Morgan goes ahead with this camp?
Well, the first threat is that these 1,000 construction workers would be building 518 kilometers of the Trans Mountain Kinder Morgan pipeline through Sequipmuk territory, in which the Sequipmuk people have not given their consent for. This is important to note because the free, prior, informed consent must be received by the Indigenous people in order for these development projects to go through. These are international Indigenous and human rights standards that must be abided by, that Canada, BC, or the company is not abiding by. And so it was a really slap in the face for us when Kinder Morgan applied for a permit for this 1,000-man camp to be placed in Blue River. They're proposing it to be 18 or 16 hectares in some of the most spiritually and culturally significant areas within our territory, areas where there's endangered caribou herds, areas that are the sacred headwaters to some of the biggest rivers here in British Columbia, the salmon being a keystone species and important to Indigenous communities and communities all the way from the tributary and the headwaters all the way to the coast, to the Salish Seas.
But I want to go back to the original question. What about the violence against women? What proof is there about violence against women if this camp is built?
Yeah, there's many different reports that have come out from different areas that have been impacted by resource extraction where their man camps are. And there's been reports from the United Nations, from the Special Rapporteur, James Anaya, that has put and connected a direct connection between the increase of violence against women, including rape and assault, around women around these extractive projects. Some of the statistics are staggering in that there's 248 rapes a year in some of those communities that have increased, you know, four times. The increase of 17% alone in rapes around these communities. And this is really important because we trust and believe in our sisters that are telling us, do not let these man camps come in. We have our relatives that are around the Alberta tar sands. We have relatives that are in North Dakota through ceremony. We know, we hear firsthand accounts. It's not just these reports. You know, even Mark Zuckerberg of Facebook posted something about Williston, North Dakota, a fracking community with man camps, that the ratio between men and women, 10 to 1, and at its height, it was 30 to 1. And you see the direct increase in the violence against women. And we're not going to take these statistics and this data and these testimonials from these women lightly. This is very serious for us as Indigenous women in our community. Indigenous women are the most over-policed in this society. If we're so over-policed, how come the numbers of murdered or missing Indigenous women just continue to grow? We should be solving these. We should be finding who's murdering and who's kidnapping and stealing our women out of our communities. But we're not. That's why there's a whole federal inquiry into it. And this is like ignoring the most vulnerable. It's ignoring the most marginalized in our community, which are Indigenous women. And we feel the brunt of it all the time. We just went to take a site visit at Blue River, where there's a population of under 200 right now. And there's industrial workers up there. Myself, I don't feel safe when there's two truckloads of industrial workers driving up to me. I don't. Because I speak, because I'm so vocal against these man camps, I'm so vocal against this pipeline.
We reached out to Kinder Morgan on this one, and they said Trans Mountain has developed a worker code of conduct outlining expectations and requirements regarding worker conduct during construction of the project. They have a zero tolerance for any violence. Is that not good enough?
No, that's not good enough, because we know firsthand when you get 1,000 men together the type of atmosphere that creates. We see it in the military. We see it in the prison system. I know firsthand. My husband is locked up in a level 4 maximum security prison in the United States. One unit has 1,000 men. He tells me every day, there's no way that I'm going to have you around 1,000 men. It's not a safe place for you. And so I hear this firsthand from men that are in the military, of the atmosphere that it creates when you get 1,000 men together. This is not just fairy tales. This is actual real life. The first man camps that were ever set up in Canada was actually Canada itself. It was the Hudson Bay Company that prohibited European wives and women from coming with them. And that's the very beginning of the violence against Indigenous women began.
Your group plans to present this declaration to Kinder Morgan CEO Ian Anderson tomorrow. What message are you sending to him and to the province?
We're sending the message that they don't have the consent for this pipeline. They don't have a consent to issue permits for this man camp. It's very important that people understand that the province and the Canadian government are also involved, because they're the ones that issue the permits to these corporations to build these man camps or these pipeline through our land. So those are also our target, and we're also addressing the provincial and the federal government too, is that they don't have the consent to issue permits for this man camp to be built.
And Ken Hoos, what sort of response are you looking for from the company? What do you want to hear from them?
Well, we want to take the lead from some of these other communities that have called for moratoriums on man camps. There's places in the United States that have been impacted by the man camps coming into their territory or their nations, and now there's actual moratoriums. They're banning man camps from their communities because they see the impact so greatly impacting the women in the communities. So we don't want to take anything less than that. We want to call on a moratorium for man camps within our nation, and our nation is massive. It's 180,000 kilometers. Over half of the pipeline is proposed to cross through our lands. We must be respected, and we must be listened to.
Ken Hoos, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you.
Take care. Ken Hoos Manuel is with the Secwepemc Women's Warrior Society. What do you make of what you just heard? You can offer your thoughts on TalkBack at 604-662-6690, or you can email us earlyed@cbc.ca. Here's Amy Bell.
It's been a real mess at the Massey Tunnel. We're starting to see some improvement. So we had that southbound crash in the only southbound lane. It's been pulled out of the tunnel and off into the pullout lane, so not causing an issue. The big issue, though, is the two separate northbound crashes just north of the tunnel. So one is before the Steveston off-ramp, the other is just past it, and we have the right and left lanes blocked. So they were working to clear it. The tow trucks are there, but still causing big backups. You're lining up close to Highway 17 now. A lot of people making tracks for the Alex Fraser, so it's busy from well before 64th. Patello traffic is heavy, and we have a crash now southbound Scott Road at 103rd. Still clearing a collision off Highway 1 westbound before 232nd, and generally just seeing a big push of volume now for all the major routes, and streets relatively dry at this point. We're not going to see the rain until later today, and it'll be very heavy overnight. Winds will pick up off the water as well. Back with more in about 10 minutes.
Coming up today on The Current, some 6 million Canadians cannot get the dental care they need because they simply cannot afford it. Checkups are too expensive, too few and far between. and many times have painful consequences. Well, today in The Current, we'll hear from Canadians in discomfort because they lack access to vital services. That's on Filling the Gaps, Dental Care in Canada, a special edition on The Current with your host, Anna Maria Tremonti, right after us at 8:37 this morning here on CBC Radio 1. Minutes now before 7 o'clock. You know, in the wake of the Harvey Weinstein scandal, the film industry has been forced to take a hard look at how it treats women. Women make up less than 20% of the people making movies and decisions in Hollywood, and that dynamic is starting now to shift at the Whistler Film Festival. It opens today with a record number of films directed by women. And this weekend, the festival hosts the second annual Women on Top event with a keynote address by producer Susan Cartsonis. Now, she spent a decade as an executive of 20th Century Fox. She produced hits like What Women Want, and she has long been a champion for gender parity in the film business. And we're delighted to have Susan with us on the line this morning. Hello there.
Hello. Good morning.
Welcome to BC.
Well, thank you. I've been here for a little while now.
There you go. Why are women so underrepresented in the movie industry still today in the 21st century?
I would say that it's institutional sexism and habit. I don't think that there's, and I think that we see it reflected across industries. The film industry isn't very different from corporate boards or any other discipline, really. There's a barrier to entry because at the very, very top, the decision makers are male. And we naturally, as human beings, veer toward what we've seen before, what feels comfortable. And often that means sort of sticking with one's own gender. So the consciousness raising that's happening is a really healthy thing, because when you're conscious that something is unequal, it becomes possible to really take a look at it and change it. And I'm so, so impressed by Canada for being a leader in doing that. I'd love to see the United States, and particularly the government, you know, take a look at the over half of the human beings who pay taxes, who are women, and take a look at sort of governmental policies about gender parity and try to enforce that, as well as consciousness raise. So. Yeah.
Susan, what do you make of what's going on in your industry right now? And it started with Harvey Weinstein. We're seeing more and more men in influential positions being taken down now by this. What do you think when the dust settles, what will this mean for your industry?
Well, I think that, you know, the good men who exist in the industry, and there are many of them, not every man in the industry is a sexual predator, like Harvey Weinstein appears to be. I think that there will be a consciousness, more of a consciousness about the inequalities. And I think that, I hope that the takeaway will be that, we've created an industry that's known for exploring human experience. That's what movies do. And we're only representing half of the world of human experience by representing male stories and male-generated stories. The perspective of women is sadly underrepresented. And I hope that the industry will be a safer place for women and men to work in, because the notion of their safety, you know, their personal safety and their job safety, will become more of a priority within the business.
How do you figure, though? How do we let it exist for so long? Because the casting couch was a joke years ago and sort of the dirty little secret, but everybody knew about it, but nobody did anything about it.
Well, you know, I think that when you have a kind of monolithic leadership that protects itself you're going to find a situation that protects and creates an environment where harassment, inequality, and even, sexual predators can thrive. And I think that it's always a healthier environment when there's gender parity. And I think that research will show that mixed teams are more successful because let's face it, we balance each other out. You know, when there's variety in gender, there's more diversity of opinion. Also, I hate to be chauvinistic about women, but I have also seen research that shows that where women lead, all diversity follows. And all inclusion follows. We are either by nature or nurture very inclusive and collaborative. I was talking to a choreographer the other day that says if I take a group of female dancers and I ask them to dance together, they're in sync in no time at all. If I put a group of men together and I say, you guys dance together, and I don't give them any instruction, they're all doing their own thing in another little section. Our brains work differently. We're different human beings. And when we all come together, there's more balance and there's more success. So it's a huge priority. It's hugely important. And what the Whistler Film Festival is doing is a fantastic thing by evening the playing field. You know, it's a great thing to showcase, highlight the accomplishments of female filmmakers.
What was it like for you years ago? I mean, you're at the vanguard of this. And as I mentioned, well, no, but you are. You produced What Women Want, okay, which was
right.
Is still now considered a classic. Big cast, Mel Gibson, Helen Hunt, still a movie that I watch today when it's on television. What was it like in those back then, because that's a few years ago now, to produce that movie? What did you run up against in putting that movie together because you were a female?
Well, for one, I don't walk around saying I'm a female or I'm a woman filmmaker. I walk around saying, how can I help people whose voices haven't been heard? And how can I create a dialogue about what's going on that's entertaining through my work? And What Women Want is a perfect example of that. It's a scoundrel of a guy who is thinking all sorts of thoughts about women, and his life gets turned around when he can hear what they actually think. It's both his, the dream of his life and the worst thing that could possibly happen.
It's almost like a documentary for what's going on right now, isn't it?
It is, and one of the reasons I wanted so much to make that movie is because I think it's an important and entertaining subject. I think it can be very funny to look at the differences between the sexes, and I wanted a movie that would make people laugh and cry and that they'd leave the theater talking to each other. And when I say people, I mean men and women, you know, that it would create a really fun conversation, because I think that I think it's important. So when I started out, I was often the only woman in a room full of 30 people. And fortunately, I'm the bossy big sister of five kids and a family, and I've never had a problem making my voice heard. That doesn't mean that in the industry I haven't been bullied, discriminated against, and that I haven't suffered, you know, for because of my gender. But I really sought out people who would mentor me. Sometimes they were men. In the case of What Women Want, I sold the movie to Sherry Lansing, who was the then head of Paramount, and the president of production was Michelle Manning, who is also a woman, and Mel Gibson jumped on board and helped finance it, and Nancy Myers was the director of the film. It was only her second film as a director.
And Susan, I'm sorry we have to jump in here because we've run out of time, but I'm really sorry. But congratulations on all you've accomplished, and
thank you
for your time. Susan Cartsonis, film producer, co-founder of Resonate Entertainment, giving the keynote address this weekend at Women on Top as part of the Whistler Film Festival. Headlines. Here's Drew.
The mayor of Port Coquitlam has decided 10 years of civic politics is enough. Greg Moore says he won't seek re-election next year. Amy Bell now with a look at traffic.
It is a mess at the Massey Tunnel thanks to two northbound collisions at the north end. Your best bet to avoid the Massey Tunnel and head for the Alex Fraser. More details coming up right after the news.
It's 7 o'clock. World Report is next here on CBC Radio 1. Good morning. I'm Rick Clough. This is the Early Edition. It's Wednesday. It's the 29th day of November. And it's going to be windy, perhaps a little wet. Who knows? Amy Bell's got it all covered for us. She's going to be here in just a couple of moments. Our top story this half hour, the Supreme Court of Canada will be hearing arguments from Trinity Western University and the Law Society of BC tomorrow in a case that places equality rights against religious freedoms. We're going to hear from the head of Trinity Western's proposed School of Law in a few moments. That's coming up. But first, Drew Karakas with headlines from our CBC Vancouver newsroom.
Rick, Vancouver police have issued a warning about a sexual predator who has now been released and is living in a halfway house in the city. The long-serving mayor of Port Coquitlam has decided 10 years in politics is enough, and a new monument has been unveiled in the Okanagan recognizing the trauma suffered by survivors of Canadian residential schools. More local news at 7:30. Now over to Amy Bell with traffic and weather.
Yep, still a mess at the Massey Tunnel. They've cleared one of the two collisions that happened northbound at the north end of the Massey Tunnel near Steveston, but still seeing huge delays. It's well backed up before Highway 17. If you do use the Massey Tunnel, stick to the counterflow lane. That's the best way to bypass these issues. But at this point, you could head for the Alex Fraser, although keep in mind, many people are doing just that this morning, so it is lined up solid almost to Highway 10. Very busy as well as you're making your way towards the Patello Bridge. And if you're coming along Scott Road, we've got a flipped vehicle northbound on Scott Road between 99th and 103rd. Cleared the crash on Highway 1 westbound near 232nd, but very heavy coming out of Abbotsford through into Langley and then again crawling through Burnaby Lake. Starting to see delays building now for the Knight Oak and Arthur Lang. And we still have single lane alternating traffic on Highway 7 just east of Agassiz after earlier problems. And Bradner Road closed from Fraser Highway to Simpson with some downed power lines. We will see more clouds this morning, and then later today we'll see showers or some rain. Winds will pick up a bit off the water. It's overnight that we see that rain really coming down. See 20 to 30 millimeters. It'll stay windy near the water and a low down to 6, and that rain will taper to afternoon showers tomorrow. Back with more in about 10 minutes.
Thanks, Amy. Now 12 minutes past 7 o'clock here on the Early Edition on CBC Radio 1. The legal battle over Trinity Western University's proposed law school reaches the Supreme Court this week. Now, the controversy centers on the faith-based university's community covenant. The covenant bans students from having sexual relationships outside of a traditional heterosexual marriage. Now, in 2014, law societies in BC, Ontario, and Nova Scotia refused to accredit Trinity grads, arguing the school's covenant discriminated against the LGBTQ community. Last year, BC and Nova Scotia's courts of appeal ruled in favor of Trinity's arguments for religious freedom. Meanwhile, Ontario's Court of Appeal has ruled the opposite. On Thursday, TWU and the Law Society of BC will be in the Supreme Court of Canada, in the appellant court, I should say, to appeal these previous rulings. And for more on this, we're joined by Earl Phillips. Mr. Phillips is the executive director of Trinity Western University's proposed School of Law, and he's on the line with us now. Good morning.
Good morning.
First up, what's the current status of your law school, given different provincial courts ruling for and against you over the past number of months?
Well, we have not been able to open, and that's because once the BC Law Society reversed its original decision in our favor, the Minister of Advanced Education said he could no longer approve our degree program. So the Minister of Advanced Education has to approve any new degree to be offered by any post-secondary institution in BC. We had that approval, but when we lost the approval at the BC Law Society, the minister said, I need to pull this and let you pursue your litigation in the meantime.
Which is what you've done, and what arguments will Trinity Western be bringing forward to the Supreme Court this week?
Well, there's a number of arguments and a number of important issues. I think the quickest way to summarize it would be to say We are arguing that the society that we think the Charter of Rights contemplates for Canada should allow for a distinctly Christian university to operate in accordance with its views and beliefs and faith, as long as it operates in a peaceable, respectful, and lawful way.
Your website describes the proposed law school as a faith-based law school.
Yes.
Why does Canada need a faith-based law school?
Well, there's no such law school in Canada now. There's not even any private law school in Canada. And we believe this would really add to the diversity of legal education in Canada.
But your lawyers, when they graduate, will serve in our courts. We don't have faith-based police forces. We don't have faith-based courts. Why do we need faith-based lawyers?
You have a lot of faith-based lawyers in Canada already. There are many lawyers of faith, and not just the Christian faith, but of a variety of faiths, who serve all their clients well, who meet all the requirements for practicing law, who operate and conduct themselves ethically and professionally in accordance with all codes of conduct that apply to them, and yet they believe that they are serving as lawyers and serving in their faith.
Ontario's Court of Appeal ruled your community covenant, and I quote here, discriminates against LGBTQ persons by forcing them to renounce their dignity and self-respect in order to obtain an education, unquote. How do you justify keeping the covenant in light of such a strongly worded legal judgment that it's a tool of discrimination?
Well, I read the BC Court of Appeal decision, which is starkly different. And that's one of the interesting things that will be faced by the Supreme Court of Canada this week, is that there are these two very different decisions on the same issue and the same facts. And the BC Court of Appeal talks about the ideals of what the Charter calls a free and democratic society. The BC Court of Appeal, among many other things, says a society that cannot admit of and accommodate differences cannot be a truly free and democratic society. And the BC Court of Appeal was rendering their decision after the Ontario Court of Appeal decision, so they actually addressed those issues that the Ontario Court of Appeal addressed and came to a different conclusion.
But how can Trinity Western itself be a free and democratic society if you force your students to abide by this community covenant?
We are a distinctive Christian community operating within the laws of Canada, operating peacefully, respectfully, and exercising our rights under the Charter of Rights for freedom of conscience and religion, freedom of expression, freedom of association. We are a private institution, and we operate in a way that is consistent with our Christian faith. And if we
are restricted,
this is not just a restriction on Trinity Western University. It's not just on evangelical Christians. It's on the entire Christian church. It's on all faiths, and it actually will detrimentally affect the full freedom of conscience and religion of all Canadians.
But you use the word freedom. With all due respect, you don't allow the people of your community, your students, to express their freedom of sexual orientation.
The covenant that we have applies to everybody equally. It talks about practicing Christian virtues, love, peace, gentleness, kindness, mercy, justice. That applies to everybody. And we put that before everyone. And we do have gay and lesbian students who willingly and voluntarily come to Trinity Western because they like what they can get there.
We put this in the context as a backdrop of this is what happened yesterday, this historic apology from the Prime Minister to the LGBTQ2 community for state-sanctioned discrimination. We heard about the abuse of people and the abuse they faced because they weren't considered equal. They lost their jobs. They were jailed. The Law Society of BC says this case puts two charter rights up against each other, equality rights and religious freedom. So why should religious freedom be given more weight than ensuring equal rights?
When you talk about equality rights under the Charter, you're talking about the obligation of the state to treat everyone equally under the law. And that means everyone, regardless of their sexual orientation or regardless of their religion. So there are religious equality rights under the Charter as well. So it's not a conflict between two Charter rights.
But you don't treat your students equally, do you? You've got different rules for gays and straights, and you make them all abide by this particular community covenant.
We have the same rule for gays and straights. And the same rule is that sexual relations should be confined to marriage between a man and a woman. That applies to straight students as well as gay students.
What do you expect the Supreme Court to say today or this week?
Yeah, well, we probably won't get a decision until sometime next spring. But I remain confident that when you look at the charter cases that we have had over the last several years, and especially in the last few years, I think that a decision in our favor is very much in line with what the Supreme Court of Canada has been talking about in this area of the law recently. So I'm quite confident and hopeful.
Earl Phillips, thank you so much for your time this morning. We very much appreciate it.
You're very welcome.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Earl Phillips is the executive director of Trinity Western University's proposed law school. Now, we invited the Law Society of BC to join us in this conversation. They declined, but they did send this statement, and it reads, quote, "As the case is currently before the Supreme Court of Canada, we cannot comment beyond saying that this case involves two important charter rights, which have to be balanced. The Supreme Court of Canada is best situated to consider all the facts and find the appropriate balance for these fundamental rights," unquote. So now we throw it out to you. What do you think of Trinity Western's arguing it should have the right to create a faith-based law school and have its students abide by this community covenant? You can offer your thoughts on TalkBack at 604-662-6690, 604-662-6690. You can email us at earlyed@cbc.ca, or you can tweet us right now and join the conversation on Twitter at CBC Early Edition. Here's Amy Bell.
Still a mess at the Massey Tunnel. We've got one of the two collisions at the north end remaining. So it's off to the shoulder now, but still causing huge backups. You're lining up solid from well before Highway 17. Very busy as well as you make your way out of the tunnel and then carry on through to the Oak Street Bridge. So you could head for the Alex Fraser. At this point, don't know if it's going to save you much time. It is lined up solid to almost Highway 10, and they just cleared a stall off the 91 that was near 64. So very, very busy out of Delta. We have a flipped vehicle northbound on Scott Road near 103rd, so expect delays there. Cleared the problem that was on Highway 1 westbound at 232nd, and very heavy on Highway 1 throughout Burnaby Lake. It's just crawling at times, and we are starting to see things building off the North Shore. We're also seeing increasing cloud, and we'll get into some showers or slightly heavier rain by the end of the day, and then overnight we're getting a lot of rain and wind and more rain to start tomorrow. Take a brief break for showers and then back to the rain on Friday.
Well, as you've been hearing in the news, Greg Moore, the mayor of Port Coquitlam, the chair of Metro Vancouver, is calling it quits. He announced yesterday on Twitter he will not seek re-election next year after 16 years in municipal politics.
Yeah, I've been doing this for 16 years, 10 years as mayor, and I think it was just the right time for our family and the right time for the city. I believe in term limit. 10 years seems like a nice number to leave on. You know, we've got some exciting stuff happening in Port Coquitlam. We're doing a downtown action plan to get more development and create a real cool urban buzz in Port Coquitlam. We've got some great transit initiatives that we're working on to increase transit around our community. We're building a new rec center, looking at regional economic development and prosperity with different players from around the region has been something long coming and working hard on that. So, there's still a lot to do, and I'm excited about the next 10 months. I know a lot of people will ask, you know, oh, you're going to go to another level of politics. No, I have no desire to seek provincial or federal positions, and I want to finish strong as the mayor of Port Coquitlam, the chair of Metro Vancouver, and support whoever's coming next so they can be as successful as well.
Greg Moore, outgoing mayor of Port Coquitlam and chair of Metro Vancouver, not seeking re-election next year. Imagine having full-time work and still having to visit a food bank. This is the reality of a growing number of citizens in our province, and there are now 100 food banks operating in BC, and they help families like this.
Good morning. My name is Isabel Noah. So I'm working full-time as a customer service. My job doesn't pay me enough, so this is why I'm here. I'm a single parent, and I have to say that every 2 weeks when I have to come and pick up some food, some fresh vegetables, diapers, and canned food, I have to say that it's really helpful because I can save the amount of money that usually I spend in the groceries. I can put it in the daycare or in the dentist or these eye appointments, so I have to pay everything by myself. Daycare is very expensive. It's $300 per month, so by coming to Surrey Food Bank, I can save, let's say, $150, and those $150 goes directly to his daycare.
Isabel is one of over 100,000 British Columbians who depend upon food banks each and every month. And on Friday, day after tomorrow, December the 1st, it is our 31st annual CBC Open House and Food Bank Day. This is the day we set aside every year to encourage you to donate to the food bank of your choice anywhere in BC. The pledge lines will be open on Friday. If you want to donate now, right now, you can online at cbc.ca/BC. Look for the red Open House Food Bank Day banner. Click on that, then go to the Donate Now button, and you can make your contribution. And if it's more than $20, you almost instantly get a tax receipt for that. And if you happen to be here in Vancouver on Friday, downtown, say around, 700 Hamilton Street, drop in and say hello. Our doors are open from 6 in the morning to 6 in the evening. We've got all sorts of special programming planned in both radio and television. Lots of music as well, so come on by and enjoy the fun as we celebrate our 31st annual Open House and Food Bank Day here at CBC Vancouver. 26 minutes now past 7 o'clock. David Blair joins us from the CBC Business Desk. Howdy.
Good morning.
So I can't get my head wrapped around this. I never have been able to, and maybe you can help explain this to me. Cryptocurrency, Bitcoin, which isn't really a coin, and it's just a bunch of bits. But now it's worth a huge whack of dough.
Yeah, it's a very interesting story. This morning, the cryptocurrency Bitcoin blowing past $11,000 US for one Bitcoin. So this is a new record high price. This is the perhaps the most incredible story this year in the investment world. Investors are piling in to an intangible currency. In January of this year, one Bitcoin was trading at under $1,000. So that means we're seeing over 1,000% gain in 1 year. In June, it was worth $2,800. In October, it was worth $5,000. Yesterday, it hit $10,000. And this morning, it's at $11,000. That's a 10% increase in 1 day. If you took all of the 500 companies that are listed on the S&P 500, the stock index, and the value of Bitcoin today is greater than 470 of them. So only 30 companies are larger than that. It is awe-inspiring to watch. I want to say awesome, but, you know, it kind of lost its meaning.
Yeah.
But it is awe-inspiring to watch what is happening right here. Bitcoin is a currency, okay? It's like a dollar, but it's not backed up by any government, and it's not backed up by taxpayers. You can't even physically hold it because it's all done online. But you can buy stuff with it if a retailer is willing to accept it as a currency. It's a cash substitute. It in itself has no intrinsic value. It is supported by investors' belief in its value. And that value is skyrocketing because we now have venture capitalists and institutional investors that have started to believe that Bitcoin could gain wide acceptance. And so they are buying into this cryptocurrency, piling money into it. And because there are a limited supply of cryptocurrencies, it's like you put more money in, it goes up, you know? So this is sending the value soaring. Some traders say this is just pure speculation. Others say they're pretty skeptical that this could be the biggest bubble of our lifetime. So as Bitcoin trades over $11,000 US this morning, it is still the most wild ride in the investment world. But hold on to your hat.
Yeah, no kidding. What are some other numbers on the markets today?
We have the Toronto Stock Exchange down 32 points right now. It's just a little bit below 16,000. The Dow Jones now trading at all new fresh record highs this morning, up 84 points at the moment. It had been a little bit higher this morning, but it's at 23,920. The Dow Jones had been higher. The S&P 500 had been higher. Right now, it's down just 1 point. And the oil this morning is down 23 cents a barrel. It is at $57.76 U.S. a barrel.
All right, sir. We'll chat one more time.
Bye-bye.
David Blair at the CBC Business Desk. Amy Bell is here, and it's been a busy morning.
Yeah, pretty awful morning trying to get out of Delta. We've had two separate problems at the Massey Tunnel, still dealing with one at the north end. So it is lining up way before Highway 17, between Liner Trunk and Highway 17. However, the Alex Fraser has been the alternate, and it's now lining up solid from Highway 10. So not much better there. I'll have all the details of traffic and weather after the news.
And with that 7:30 news, here's Drew Karakas.
Good morning. It's 3 degrees and mostly cloudy in Vancouver. Vancouver police say a convicted sex offender has been released from custody and is now living in a halfway house in the city. Investigators say the man poses a significant risk of committing sexual offenses against children. The CBC's Mira Baines reports.
Vancouver police have released a statement warning the public about 35-year-old Christian Otto Olsen. He's been convicted of crimes including sexual assault, child pornography offenses, and sexual interference and touching. Police say that Federal Correctional Services have assessed Olsen as being at a very high risk of sexually reoffending. He's living in a Vancouver halfway house. Olsen's release is bound by several court-imposed conditions. They include that he must wear an electronic monitoring device and not be near places where children congregate, such as schools, parks, and rec centers, or be friends with any person that has parental responsibility. He's described as Indigenous, 5 feet 8 inches tall, 200 pounds, with a stocky build, light brown hair and eyes. Police say people who are at risk include female and male children and teenagers, including acquaintances and the general public. VPD is asking anyone who sees him violating his conditions to call 911 immediately. Mira Baines, CBC News, Vancouver.
There is a picture of Olsen on our website, cbc.ca/BC. Port Coquitlam Mayor Greg Moore has decided not to seek re-election next November. Moore has been mayor of Port Coquitlam for 10 years and says it just feels like the right time to step down. Before the next election, though, he says there's still a lot he wants to accomplish.
We're doing a downtown action plan to get more development. We've got some great transit initiatives that we're working on. We're building a new rec center. Still a lot to do, and I'm excited about the next 10 months and finishing strong.
Moore's advice for anyone looking to take over his seat, consult your loved ones. He says the support from his family has been key to his success. The family of Ella Hernandez, one of two girls killed in a crash in Coquitlam back in May, is looking to leave a legacy in her name. They're pushing the city of Coquitlam to commit to making the roads safer. Stephen Brunel speaks for Ella's parents, Michelle and Gary.
They would like, one, the city and the mayor to say publicly, we will do everything we can to make this road safer. And secondly, if they would announce that at a council meeting or something so it's on the public record. So Michelle and Gary know that they are trying to do something.
But Brunel says the city won't meet with the family because there's a lawsuit about the crash. The family argues the lawsuit has nothing to do with improving road safety in Coquitlam. Indigenous people from around the Okanagan gathered yesterday for the unveiling of a monument recognizing the trauma suffered by residential school survivors. As Brady Strachan reports, the monument is located at a spot where children were once loaded onto cattle trucks and taken away from their families.
Once a place of tragedy, this site is now a spot of healing and recognition. A metal sculpture of two Indigenous parents welcoming their children into their arms was unveiled yesterday. Elder Jack Kruger is a residential school survivor.
I think it's important for people to know the story because never again would I ever like to see this happen to anybody else.
Kruger says at this spot, children were put on cattle trucks and taken off to a residential school. It
took a whole day to go from here to Kamloops, for instance. And to go to bathroom, they had to go to bathroom on themselves, or it was very traumatizing. Even some kids just fell in the manure, and they just didn't have any energy to get up.
Kruger says he's still recovering from his experience, but he's hopeful for the children of his community who he says have a bright future ahead of them. Brady Strachan, CBC News on the Penticton Indian Band.
Statistics Canada has released the latest batch of data from the 2016 census. Some of it details commuting patterns in Canada. The CBC's Tanya Fletcher has a look at how cities in BC compare with the rest of the country.
Overall, the data show urban centers are increasingly becoming the place where Canadians live and work. Nearly 74% of all commuters in Canada now live or work in a city of 100,000 people or more. That's up from about 70% 2 decades ago. Of the three largest metropolitan areas, commuters from Toronto were most likely to use sustainable transportation. That includes public transit, walking, cycling, and carpooling. Vancouver was next, with 40% of the population using sustainable transportation, and Montreal came in third. Among the mid-sized cities, Victoria led the country in active transportation, in other words, walking or cycling to work. And of the smaller centres, Abbotsford Mission made the list for the highest proportion of carpoolers. 32% of commuters from there work in the Vancouver area. Tanya Fletcher, CBC News, Vancouver.
It's now 7:35, and that's the CBC News.
Thank you, Drew. Amy.
Mm-hmm. Bad morning for the Massey Tunnel. We had we sort of kicked off the morning commute with two problems, both northbound at the north end. One's been completely cleared. They're still working to clear the last one. It's off to the side, but the damage has so been done. So it is lining up way before Highway 17 and building, unfortunately, as we get close to the sort of peak of the morning commute around 8 o'clock. We have a lot of people that have opted for the Alex Fraser as an alternate, and at this point it's lining up from Highway 10. There was also a stall quickly near 64th that got moved off to the side, but again, it wasn't quick enough, so it really added to the delays. So it's going to take some time to get out of Surrey and Delta. We also have a problem in Surrey with a flipped vehicle that was northbound on Scott near 103rd. If you're there, I'd love an update, though, at *690. Highway 1 is not too bad this morning out of Abbotsford through Langley, but then once you cross over the bridge, you're finding a lot of volume trying to get through Burnaby Lake. We're seeing that big backup now for the Cassiar Tunnels. It is building off the North Shore, and it's going to get a bit busier before it gets better, unfortunately. At least the streets have been dry. We've just seen a few scattered showers, and we'll see that for the rest of the day. It's later on this afternoon, evening, that we head back into the rain, and then it really ramps up tonight. We'll see about 20 to 30 millimeters overnight. The wind's picking up near the water. High of 9 today, low down to 6. More rain to start tomorrow before it tapers off to showers, and then rain for Friday, Saturday, but a mix of sun and cloud on Sunday. I'll be back with more traffic and weather in about 10 minutes.
Are you in the holiday spirit yet?
You betcha. Gotcha. Well, you know what? I need a couple more days.
Well, there is Friday, of course.
That's what does it.
Have you got your tree up?
Sadly, yes. I am very staunch in not doing anything before December 1st. My children do not share that sentiment.
Well, and I'm sure they're part of a large gathering.
It's true.
Well, if this helps make you feel more in the holiday spirit, I was spinning the dowel yesterday and the burning logs back.
That's right.
Even the burning logs making an early appearance. So the festive holiday log you can find, and if you play the appropriate music, you can get right into it.
It's true, though there's no Christmas carols at my house until December 1st.
Which is?
Friday.
And also happens to be?
Food bank and open house day.
See?
The best day.
There you go. Come on down and say hello. We throw the doors open at 6 in the morning, and you can see programs produced. We'll be live on the air, as will BC Almanac, as well on the coast. All programs have music attached to them, so we'll have the Sojourners as our house band, which is great. Jill Barber's going to be making a special appearance. And, of course, Corleone.
Yep.
Christopher Gaze is going to be here.
Lovely.
David Suzuki is going to be here. Mm-hmm. You're going to be here.
It's true.
Drew Carrick, as you can find. He won't be on stage with us, but you'll meet him later.
Yeah, you can come meet a lot of personalities.
Yeah, so come on down and help us raise money and awareness for food banks, more than 100 food banks that operate across this province.
Such a great cause.
Yeah, that's on the first, day after tomorrow. 21 minutes now before 8 o'clock, time to check sports and once again say good morning to Matt Cullen.
Good morning, Rick. Sounds like you and your team are all ready for the holidays.
Well, sort of, yeah. Food bank day first, and then the holidays.
Sounds good. And then cue the Christmas carols.
Maybe.
Okay. Fair enough. Well, Canucks weren't interested in Christmas carols last night for sure. A tough night in Brooklyn against the Islanders, looking to snap a two-game losing streak. But the game sounded a lot like this.
All the way over for Barzell, then for Everly, score!
Nice pass from Coquitlam native Matthew Barzell, setting up Jordan Eberle to make it 3-1 Islanders. Anders Nielsen had to deal with that loud horn all night long. What a rookie season, though, it's been for Barzell. 7-game point streak now. Leads all rookies, by the way. Two better than Vancouver's Brock Besser. Islanders won it 5-2, so three straight losses for the Vancouver Canucks. And Matt Barzell played his minor hockey at the Burnaby Winter Club. Also, Kyle Turris spent a lot of his hockey, his childhood playing at the Burnaby Winter Club. He plays for Nashville now. He's one of the newest members of the Predators, and the Canucks finish their 6-game road trip Thursday in Nashville. So fans in the Lower Mainland will get a chance to look at new Westminster's Kyle Turris in a Predators uniform for the first time. He was traded from Ottawa this year, and Rick Turris is a former Grandview Steeler Junior B team, a team that I actually used to play goaltender for in the Lower Mainland.
No kidding.
There you go. And I think Turris likes his new home. 7 points in 9 games with his new team in Nashville. So we'll keep an eye on that. And let's move over to some soccer. They also a big day for soccer fans. The second leg of the MLS Conference semifinal goes tonight between Toronto FC and the Columbus Crew. If TFC can win tonight against Columbus, it would mean 2 championship games in the span of mere weeks for Toronto. Of course, that coming on the heels of the Argonauts' thrilling run and victory in the Grey Cup. Imagine that. I still can't get over it. Toronto, a winning sports city. Can't quite get over that one yet.
Oh, come on.
It's going to happen, maybe. Anyway, yeah. The first leg, close game, nil-nil draw. So Toronto has to win outright or prevail somehow after a scoreless draw. Kickoff 4:30 at BMO Field in Toronto. Talking, finally, a bit about golf. Tiger Woods is making another comeback.
I miss playing golf for fun. Go out there and hit and giggle and play for some denominations and have a good time. I had done that in 2 years. I play 9 holes here and 18 holes here, and then I have to take 3 days off because my back was killing me. And I hadn't been able to play fun golf like that with my friends in such a long time.
Tiger Woods sounding a lot different than he used to. Hard to believe, Rick, a 14-time major winner, Tiger Woods, talking more about giggles, hitting, and just having fun playing golf. Totally a different attitude. I kind of got surprised by that this morning.
Mm-hmm.
But he tees off tomorrow at the Hero World Challenge in the Bahamas. Number of back surgeries, some legal trouble, but the 41-year-old, former number one, will be back on the course, so we'll see how much fun he has.
All right, sir, thank you.
Thank you.
Matt Cullen at the CBC Sports Desk. It's now 18 minutes before 8 o'clock. Well, the list of high-powered men accused of sexual harassment and misconduct continues to grow. Most notably this morning, NBC Today Show host Matt Lauer fired from his job. But it's not just Hollywood executives and politicians. Sexual harassment happens in all kinds of workplaces, and getting rid of harassers doesn't necessarily change the culture overnight. Yesterday, we heard about how companies can move past the Me Too hashtag and institutionalize better protections for workers. So today, we're asking the labor movement about its role in ending sexual harassment and assault at work. On the line with me now is Marie Clark Walker of the Canadian Labor Congress, and she's on the line with us from Toronto. Hello there.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
I'm not bad this morning.
Unions have been pushing for sexual harassment policies now for a number of years. What's the next step beyond a policy on paper?
Well, I just want to go back a little bit and just say that we've been doing this work since the 1980s and 90s, when our first affiliates developed collective agreement language around sexual harassment and abuse. We had in 1981, I think, probably 20 QP locals alone had that kind of language. But it was also at the time when the Federations of Labor and the Canadian Labor Congress were putting out policy papers around sexual harassment, around equity, around gender violence issues. So, yeah, we've been doing that work for a very, very long time. And in an effort to go beyond, I mean, in the wake of not just Me Too, but going back to the Gomeshi trial, or Gomeshi accusation. We started a partnership with Western University around domestic violence at work and had a number of people, not just women, men and women, complete a survey. And I think it was surprising to see the results of that survey. Just about everyone who completed the survey knew someone or themselves had experienced sexual violence in some way, shape, or form. So it forced us to say that we needed to go beyond collective agreement language and actually try to do something. So today you'll see that we are encouraging our membership to get educated around what sexual harassment and sexual violence looks like and develop supports. Unions are developing support so that members and leaders can not only recognize and educate their members, but also know what to do when they have encountered situations like that.
When you say even so they know what to do, if your workplace has strong policies against harassment and violence, it can still be extremely difficult for someone to come forward, especially if they're a junior employee, if they're going up against a supervisor or superior, maybe even the boss. So how can unions make it easier for the victims to report and come forward?
Well, to make sure that the people who are around them are trained and know how to support, what language to use to support, and so that the members who are going through this don't feel like they're alone, don't feel like they're by themselves in this particular situation at that particular moment. We are, and as I said, as a collective agreement obtain more language like that, we also have a responsibility to ensure that the language is actually implemented so that when somebody comes forward and complains, something is actually done about it. We're moving definitely beyond hashtags and going into trying to ensure that stuff gets done. We also recognize that, you know, as you said, someone who's been sexually harassed or has to deal with violence is vulnerable to begin with, but we also recognize that there are also particular people who are more vulnerable to these types of harassment, migrant workers, indigenous workers, racialized workers, young workers, particularly those who are working in precarious environments. So we have to make sure that we are there to support and to believe them when they come forward. I mean, when you look at what's been happening down under, down south, with the number of people that have come forward, and you have people on the other side saying they don't believe them. That in itself is extremely damaging to someone who has finally gained the courage to come forward. But we have a number of initiatives. We have Unifor that has a women's advocacy program that trains advocates to go beyond just listening to what members are saying, but give them direction as to what it is they need to do. We have initiatives in unions like ACTRA, IATSE, and other unions that are in the entertainment industry that are having discussions, industry-wide discussions about harassment and how to address it. We have Unite Here, who does work in the hotel sector, who have started a very, very vocal and visual campaign, particularly in the States, around what it means to be harassed when you are going to clean a room. And the video that they have to do the education on that is pretty telling. You know, people coming to clean your room and the person on the other side is naked and telling them to come in. You know, we are seeing more and more of that, and unions actually educating not just their membership, but the general public as to what is actually happening in these work situations, and so encouraging people to speak up and speak out and be supportive of the people who are experiencing this harassment.
Yesterday, we spoke with Jennifer Birdall, who is a professor of leadership studies at UBC's Sauder School of Business. I want you to listen to part of what she had to say about changing workplace culture.
We know that certain organizational structures are prone to sexual harassment. Organizations that are dominated by men and have very few women in leadership roles have much higher rates of sexual harassment. So integrating women within those organizations and putting them into positions of power is, you know, a longer-term goal.
Do you think more women in leadership roles, Marie, would help change workplace culture?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Women have a different way of looking at things, and I believe that they would be more supportive. And the more women that you have in the leadership role, I think the more women will be believed when they come forward, and the more action can be taken to support women when they do come forward and to make them feel that they are believed and that what they have to say is worthy. The other piece of this is to push for legislative change. And that's one of the things that we've been doing in the last little while. Paid domestic leave, domestic violence leave. And people always ask, why paid? Well, if you give people unpaid leave, then it keeps that gender pay gap in check, which also doesn't allow for women to have that the money that they need to be able to do the things that they need to do. So they're more likely, if the leave is paid, to be able to leave to go and find childcare, to go and find housing, to go and find a lawyer, to go and get some support on work time. If you leave that unpaid, particularly for those marginalized workers who are working in precarious situations that cannot afford to take any time off work, then they remain, it helps them to remain in that situation. That's not what you want to do. So we're pushing for paid domestic violence leave. We've been able to accomplish that in Manitoba and Ontario, and we're looking for to other provinces to be able to do the same thing, as well as the federal government. This is not just a local, provincial, or federal initiative for us in at the Canadian Labour Congress. We are also working with the International Labour Organization, who next June will be looking at a convention and or recommendation around gender-based violence and harassment. And so we're looking to take this international. We're hoping to be more successful in Canada, of course, but looking to take this international to make sure that these issues are taken seriously and no other woman has to stand by and believe that they're not believed or stay in an abusive situation because they can't afford to go and do the things that they need to get themselves out of there.
Marie Clark Walker, thank you so much for your time this morning. We appreciate it.
Thank you so much. You have a great day.
You too. Bye-bye. Marie Clark Walker, Secretary-Treasurer of the Canadian Labour Congress. It's now 8 minutes before 8. Here's Amy.
Finally, all clear of earlier problems for the Massey Tunnel. We had two separate collisions northbound off the north end, but we can't clear that back up. It is still lining up way before Highway 17. I'd say closer to Ladder Trunk at this point. Alex Fraser, not much better. It's lined up to Highway 10. And we have a flipped vehicle northbound Scott Road near 103rd and also car with a flat Highway 1 westbound near McAllen. We'll get into the rain, but not till later today, and I'll have more before the news.
Our director, Polly Legier, is here to tell us what's up coming up after World Report.
Tara Carmen's been crunching the census numbers that have just come out. She's our data journalist, and she'll open up those numbers.
All righty. We'll look forward to that. Hey, the province is investigating claims fish processing plants are releasing contaminated effluent into the ocean. Now, the claims come from a BC photographer who visited the sites of two plants, one in the Campbell River area and the other near Tofino. Tavish Campbell says he dove deep into the water and found what he called blood water.
It is very deep and it's very dark down there. So I have two huge underwater lights that I have attached to the camera. And as I swam down towards the pipe, you know, these lights illuminated the billowing red effluent pouring out of the pipe. And within that red effluent is tons and tons of scales. So it's all kind of shimmering in the light. It's really, really eerie and pretty disgusting at the same time.
Well, the Federal Fisheries Minister, Dominic LeBlanc, says he is watching developments.
I wrote to the British Columbia Minister of the Environment to share our concern when we saw this video. I understand the BC government is conducting an investigation or an audit of the particular processing facility. Obviously, Environment Canada, which has responsibility to enforce the provisions of the Fisheries Act, which prevent deleterious substances from being put into the water, which could harm fish habitat. We're taking note of all this. We're looking into this. And obviously, if there's an appropriate enforcement action that will take place, it will take place.
So is there action that needs to take place now? Well, for more on that, on the line is Finn Donnelly, the MP for Port Moody Coquitlam. And he's a federal NDP critic for fisheries and oceans. Good morning.
Good morning, Rick.
What's your reaction to these claims about this contaminated effluent? Have you seen the video?
I have seen the video.
And what do you think?
Yeah, it's absolutely disgusting to see that pouring out into the ocean, to see salmon swimming through that and others, marine life having to put up with that. It's absolutely alarming.
How do we monitor plants like this currently?
Well, I think it's that's a provincial jurisdiction, as the minister has pointed out, and it's up to the province to ensure that's happening. But certainly there's a role for, as the minister also pointed out, federal agencies like Environment Canada and DFO. And I will remind this is just end of pipe that the minister, I think, is referring to, what comes out that pipe, but it's also what goes in. So in terms of eggs that come from other countries, we have to monitor for any disease that could be in those eggs that are being used to raise farm salmon that end up being processed. So that's a concern as well. So Fisheries and Oceans also has a role here.
Well, the DFO says in a statement that it will continue to work with all agencies involved in the regulation of fish processing facilities. But do you think the department needs to take more of a lead here? And if so, what would you like to see them do further?
No, I absolutely do. I've been calling, along with many others who've been warning the government about parasites, viruses, diseases coming from salmon farms for a long time. And I certainly welcome the investigation. I think that needs to be done. And if tests show that there is PRV or any other concerns in that bloody discharge.
PRV is?
Pyrene reovirus. And this gets really technical, Rick, with I can barely keep up. I'm not a biologist in any way or a pathologist, but certainly I've been familiar with some of the diseases and viruses and parasites that have been associated with farms. And this isn't uncommon to farms. They have to deal with disease management. That's very, very common. But what is uncommon is those farms are not in the oceans by wild salmon. So that's a huge concern. And I'd like to see, in terms of you asked for what kind of action, I've been calling, as long and many others have been saying, we need to transition this industry to a different technology that prevents these parasites, viruses, and diseases from transferring into the ocean. So it's past time, I think, that industry transfers to land-based closed containment technology.
Very briefly, Finn, what's at stake if we don't have more oversight?
Well, I think we're going to continue to see Justice Cohen warned, we're going to see more impacts on wild salmon. We could see the long-term demise of wild salmon, and some are estimating that could actually be shorter, in the near future than the longer term. So this is certainly why I've been the Fisheries and Oceans critic for 8 years, have been calling for action on this file and focused on salmon farms. Especially those right near or on wild salmon migration routes. So we need action now. We need to, I think the way forward is to move to land-based closed containment, become world leaders, separate the two. This would be a great thing for the Pacific, the West Coast, and for Canada to promote. Separate the two so you have the wild salmon fishery continue and thrive, and let the salmon farming industry thrive on land.
Finn Donnelly, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Rick.
Finn Donnelly, MP for Port Moody Coquitlam, federal NDP critic for fisheries and oceans. And like your thoughts on this story, if you've seen the video and you've read the story, heard the story here on the CBC, you can share your thoughts with us on TalkBack right now at 604-662-6690, 604-662-6690. 662-6690. We've got a minute to go now before World Report, and Drew's back with local news headlines.
A 10-year veteran of civic politics in Metro Vancouver is calling it quits. Port Coquitlam Mayor Greg Moore says he will not seek re-election next year. The family of two girls killed in a crash in Coquitlam this past spring are asking the city of Coquitlam to make the roads there safer. But a family spokesperson says the city won't meet with them because the crash is now subject of a lawsuit. More local news coming up in half an hour. Over to Amy Bell now with traffic and weather.
Still dealing with that flipped vehicle on Scott Road. It was northbound near 103rd. All emergency crews are on scene. It's not causing any major delays, but certainly something to avoid. We've got the major delays, though, heading out of Delta. It doesn't matter which way you're traveling. We had multiple collisions northbound outside the Massey Tunnel. They're all clear, but it's still lining up well before Highway 17. And, of course, everyone made their way towards the Alex Fraser. So the 91 backed up to Highway 10. Ladner Trunk Highway 10 is also very busy between the two routes and seeing a big push of volume now for Knight Oak and Arthur Lang through the Burnaby Lake area of Highway 1 and off the North Shore. And at least the rain will hold off until later today. Be quite rainy overnight as well.
It's 8 o'clock. World Report is next here on CBC Radio 1. Good Wednesday morning. I'm Rick Clough. This is the early edition. It's the 29th day of November. Coming up in this half hour of the program, how do people's commutes compare depending upon where they live in Metro Vancouver? Well, Census Canada has released the latest batch of numbers. Our data journalist Tara Carman has gone through the numbers and she'll be here with us in just a couple of moments. But first, Drew Carricas with headlines from our CBC Vancouver newsroom.
Rick, Vancouver police have issued a warning about a man with a lengthy criminal record who's now living in a halfway house in the city. The mayor of Port Coquitlam says he's not sure what the future holds, but Greg Moore has decided that 10 years in politics is enough. And there's been a big increase in the number of migrating songbirds that have been injured this autumn, and some suspect the wildfires this summer were a factor. More local news at 8:30. Now here's Amy Bell with traffic and weather.
It's been a really busy morning, especially trying to get out of Surrey and Delta. We had multiple collisions at the Massey Tunnel. They've all been cleared, but the damage has been done. So it's still heavy from Highway 17 on Highway 99. A lot of people, of course, as soon as there's trouble on the 99, head for the 91 in the Alex Fraser. So it's still going from about Highway 10. And feeder routes are just crawling. We have a new collision in New West. It's westbound on 10th Avenue, just past 2nd Street. We also still have a vehicle with a flat tire westbound Highway 1 near McCallum Road. Crews have just cleared the collision. That was at Scott Road and 103rd. So all volume is easing and very heavy through Burnaby Lake on Highway 1. Quite busy for the North Shore bridges now. And we are going to see periods of rain heading our way today. The winds will pick up. We'll get up to a high of about 9 degrees. More rain overnight, especially heavy, in fact. 20 to 30 millimeters, and those winds off the water will persist. Things will start to settle down tomorrow. We'll start off with rain and the wind, but then easing to just a few afternoon showers. Back to the rain, though, on Friday and Saturday, and we won't see the sun until Sunday, but we'll have a nice mix of sun and cloud, and we should stay dry. Back with more in about 10 minutes.
Thanks, Amy. It's now 12 minutes past 8 o'clock here on the early edition. Now, Census Canada has released numbers today.
Yes.
Which are right up your alley.
Mm-hmm.
Because they involve the commute.
I know. It's interesting.
Which is getting longer.
Especially today.
Well, I was just going to say, it's getting longer in terms of distance, mm-hmm. and I would assume getting longer in terms of time as
Very
well.
Very often, yes.
What you used to do in 20 minutes now probably takes 45.
Good luck. It depends on the day.
Yeah, it does indeed. This all according to the latest census report released this morning by Statistics Canada, and our data journalist here at CBC Vancouver, Tara Carman, has been poring over the numbers and is here to share some of the highlights. Hello there.
Good morning, Rick.
So this commute, it's getting longer in distance and in time. So first off, how long is the average commute?
So the average one-way commute time in Metro Vancouver last year was about half an hour. So that's more than the Canadian average of 26 minutes.
That doesn't seem like very long at all.
Well, that's average, don't forget. It depends where you live. The way Stats Can does this is they compare Vancouver with other major cities, because it's not really fair to compare a big city with lots of options in terms of public transit to a smaller city. So if you compare us Toronto and Montreal. We're doing well. So in Toronto, it was a 34-minute average commute one way compared to Vancouver at half an hour. And we've also got it better, slightly better than some other suburban Ontario cities like Oshawa and Barrie.
What's the most common way that people get to work now?
So we're still mostly driving. That's the bad news. But the good news is that the share of Canadians taking public transit grew way faster than the share of people driving.
How green are Vancouver commuters?
Well, as it turns out, and people in Vancouver won't like this, not as green as Toronto commuters. So what do I mean by green? Well, StatsCan defines this as walking, cycling, taking transit, or carpooling to work. So when you lump all those together, in Toronto, you get 43% of commuters using green transportation compared to about 40% in Vancouver.
So what will politicians do with these numbers now?
Well, they will look at them, I presume. I can't speak for politicians, but they'll look at these numbers and hopefully use it to inform their planning processes and their sort of infrastructure processes, looking at where the greatest need is in terms of getting commutes greener and more manageable for people.
But it's not all bad news for BC. I understand a couple of other BC communities, they topped the country when it came to commuting.
Yes. Congratulations, Victoria. So Victoria actually leads all the cities in the country in what's called active transportation, which means walking or cycling to work. So this figure in Victoria was 17% of commuters compared with about 9% in Vancouver.
Now, I understand, too, there were some interesting stories out of Abbotsford Mission.
That's right. So Abbotsford Mission had one of the highest rates in the country of people who carpool. So about the same proportion of people in Victoria who walk or cycle carpool in Abbotsford Mission. And that's about 17%. And StatsCan chalk that up to so many people commuting into Vancouver for work, which is, as we know, quite a distance.
You do this all the time. You pore over numbers and study data. What stood out for you in this?
What stood out for me? Well, I guess the fact that, you know, Vancouver prides itself so much on being active and walking and cycling, and we're doing well at that. That's the good news. We're ahead of Toronto and Montreal in terms of the people who walk and cycle, but we don't have as many people taking public transit. So, I guess it surprised me that our commuters weren't as green as we like to sometimes think of ourselves.
Something for politicians to work on.
Exactly.
Thanks, Tara.
Thank you, Rick.
Tara Carman is a CBC's data journalist here in Vancouver. And, of course, you'll hear more about the release of the census numbers today on all platforms of the CBC, on CBC Radio, CBC Television, and online at cbc.ca. Hey, coming up today on Q, as the editor-in-chief of Vanity Fair in the 1980s, Tina Brown was at the center of glitz, glamour, and gossip. And she kept a very detailed diary about her experiences at the end of every day. So her new book, The Vanity Fair Diaries, Tina dishes about New York's backbiting media world, Hollywood stars, Washington elite, British royal. She's got it all, and she'll be Tom Power's guest on Q today, right after the 10 o'clock news here on CBC Radio 1. Amy.
Yes. I'm excited to hear that interview. I've read a few excerpts.
And read the book, yeah.
Juicy stuff. We have got a crash on the Lougheed Highway. It is affecting both directions near Pitt River Road. We also have this collision in New West. It is westbound 10th Avenue, just west of 2nd Street. So seeing delays in both those areas, that's nothing compared to what we're seeing, though, today, trying to get out of Surrey and Delta after numerous problems. So Massey Tunnel still lining up well south of Highway 17. Seeing all that volume pushing through to the Oak Street Bridge now, and big delays for the Alex Fraser still on amp close to Highway 10, so it's going to take a while for things to ease today. Thankfully, though, the weather has been dry. We've seen an increase in cloud, though, and we'll get into the wet stuff later on this afternoon and overnight. I'll be back with more before the 8:30 news.
Now, this is our 150th anniversary.
Yep.
It's also the 50th anniversary of the Order of Canada.
That's right.
Yeah, very cool.
Yeah.
The awards are created to honor outstanding achievements by Canadian citizens. And today, UBC commemorates the anniversary with a very special event. event, Order of Canada recipients from right across the country will gather to discuss the future of our country. Among them will be Verna Kirkness. She's a Cree educator who has been influential in shaping Indigenous education in Canada. She received the order back in 1998, and we're delighted to have her with us here in Studio 10 this morning. Good morning and welcome.
Good morning.
You will be joining dozens of other Order of Canada recipients at UBC today. What are you most looking forward to?
I'm looking forward to sharing experiences, I think, and you know, a number of people I do know and that I will be present. And I'm looking forward to the presentations and what the panels will have to say, you know, after many of them being recipients themselves, you know. So,
Vern, I think it's fair to say Indigenous people have a contentious relationship, a past with Canada, given the history of colonialism and whatnot, which seems to be at the forefront of a lot of discussion now. What did it mean to you, a Cree woman, to receive the Order of Canada?
Well, it's almost 20 years ago, and I think it was a great honor for me. I think at the same time that we know about the history and so on, but when something like this comes up, it's like reconciliation of a sort, you know, on an individual basis even. And so any of us that have received the Order of Canada are very proud to have, to wear the leaf and, you know, the snowflake.
What's it like to put that pin on every morning?
Well, I don't put it on every morning, but I will put it on for today and for, you know, special occasions. And people recognize it. People acknowledge it. And when people, if I'm doing some public appearance somewhere, it's usually at the top of the list as to this recognition that I received. So it means a lot. It's great.
And well-deserved, I might add.
Well, thank you.
Your life's work has been to improve education for Indigenous youth, and you've especially been interested in getting more Indigenous young people into engineering, into the sciences, we'll say. Why is that important to you?
Well, this is my latest endeavor since I've retired. We started this in 2008. Dr. Ron Wasnow is really the creator of the foundation that they named after me, the Verna J. Kirkness Education Foundation. And we, in fact, run these science and engineering programs for grade 11 students every summer. It's only a one-week program, but they come on full scholarship. And we've had these programs at the University of Manitoba, Saskatchewan, University of Saskatchewan, and UBC. And this year, I'm pleased to say we're adding three more: University of Calgary, First Nations University of Canada, and the University of Ottawa. Did I say that? Yes, did I give the mm-hmm. right three mm-hmm. or to repeat one? Anyway, yes, so it's an opportunity for our students, our Indigenous students from anywhere in Canada, to have an experience in the university in the area of science and engineering, because in my experience, we've been in the arts field. We do, you know, we have many teachers, we have many people, social workers, etc. But we have not really had a significant number approach the science field and engineering. And if we're going to have true self-government of any form, we need people to be experienced in the area of science and engineering.
What are the biggest obstacles now facing or standing in the way of Indigenous students in pursuing careers in the sciences and in engineering?
Well, I think it's one of the things is I know myself from being a teacher and visiting classrooms and so on, that we really don't have the adequate facilities, especially at the high school level. We don't have the labs, you know. And oftentimes it's hard to find teachers that are science teachers that are Indigenous people, which we would like to find, you know. But we think that, and there are very few role models that from the science field. There are a few, but they're not very many. So I always think we need role models. We need proper facilities. We need teachers, you know. And I know when we get these students that come on, they love it. They just love being in the labs. I'm telling you, it's and we're surprised at how much the universities are really enjoying these programs, because the deans don't leave it just to the assistants or anyone. They're right in there too, you know. We've just had a wonderful experience, and we've already, since it started in 2008, I can't tell you the number, but we have had people, our students, come into science and engineering.
Having said that, then, final question, how can the education system better respond to the needs of Indigenous students then?
Well, especially for our high schools in our communities, we have to have upgraded labs.
Resources.
Resources. We have to have the teachers. We have to have the resources. And, it has to become a focus of attention as well. And so we think that by what we're doing, it also is creating a great interest, you know, among the community, when students go back and other students come. So I do think that it has to be supported. The science area has to be encouraged. We have some people who do there's Indigenous science, Indigenous ways of knowing. You know, I mean, our people really were natural scientists, so it's a shame that we're not as focused on that as we might be. But it's coming.
Verna, lovely to meet you. Thank you for coming in today.
Yeah, thanks very much.
Verna Kirkness, Cree educator who's been influential in shaping Indigenous education. She received the Order of Canada in 1998 and will be taking part in a special event at UBC today commemorating 50 years since the creation of the Order of Canada. 26 minutes now past 8 o'clock. Time to chat business once again with David Blair at the CBC Business Desk. And, sir, a lot of focus today on what's going on in the energy sector. The energy regulator, the NEB, is intervening in one of this country's most controversial pipeline projects. This is the Kinder Morton Trans Mountain Expansion Project. What can you tell us about this?
Yes, indeed. Today, the National Energy Board holds a meeting over the company's expansion of the Trans Mountain Pipeline. This is the controversial pipeline we've talked so much about. Kinder Morgan is asking the regulator to intervene in this dispute with the city of Burnaby. It says that its project is being blocked by the city, that Burnaby is not issuing permits required to continue construction. But the city says it needs more information before it can issue those permits. Trans Mountain Pipeline, it already exists. We know it is already shipping oil from Alberta over the Rockies through to Burnaby and then for export out of the Port of Vancouver. But the expansion of this pipeline has become a major flashpoint for everyone from activists and environmentalists to Indigenous groups and even local politicians. It's been quite a big issue, as you know. Kinder Morgan, it's kind of an interesting timing because just last week we were talking about, we were actually talking about it this week too, but when its competitor, TransCanada, is dealing with this massive leak at its Keystone Pipeline in South Dakota. And so, you know, the optics don't look very good for the company when, you know, the opponents of this project can just say, hey, look, I told you so. And so it's an interesting battle that's been going on. And today the company wants a federal order to compel Burnaby to issue the required permits. And we'll see just how this unfolds as these hearings get underway in the next few hours.
All righty. Markets today, how are they doing? And most notably, how's RBC stock doing today? And the reason I ask is because RBC has told us that they made a fair whack of dough through this
huge year. Amount. In fact, it's a landmark day in corporate history in this country, because for the first time ever, a Canadian bank has made $11.5 billion in a fiscal year. Royal Bank coming out with its earnings report this morning. Great news for investors. The annual earnings are up 10% from last year. The previous quarter, we saw RBC surprising investors by hiking the dividend twice of what analysts had expected. The stock price jumped over 10% in the past year. And this morning, it's up just under 1% on the trade at this moment in Toronto. Now, it was interesting to see the chief executive at RBC, Dave McKay, said that the earnings were, quote, robust growth. Which,
yep.
Now that RBC is the richest company in all of Canada, I think that's pretty fair to say.
Yeah.
And I just broke it down for fun to see what the annual profit is like if you broke it down to on a weekly basis. RBC Royal Bank making $221 million in profit every single week.
Yeah.
So it's a pretty strong numbers there. Don't forget, you're contributing your part from your paycheck to help Royal Bank through your bank fees, through your credit cards, your consumer loans, your lines of credit as well. So you are helping Royal Bank become the most profitable company in Canada.
All righty. How about some of the other numbers briefly? What's the buck?
Toronto stock.
The dollar doing?
Okay. The dollar is down a quarter of a cent. It's at 77.8 cents against the U.S. dollar. And the Canadian stock markets are down 58 points right now, just below 16,000. But we're still seeing a record high on the Dow Jones Industrial Average. It is up 55 points again as it pushes its way towards 24,000.
All right. Talk tomorrow.
Talk to you tomorrow.
David Blair at the CBC Business Desk, and here's Amy.
Still seeing very heavy volume for all of the major routes this morning. Exceptionally busy, especially for the Massey Tunnel and the Alex Fraser. It will take some time to ease. We also have a crash on the Lougheed near Pitt River Road and westbound on 10th Avenue near 2nd Street in New West. And rain on the way, but not until later this afternoon.
What's going on today?
It's just one of those days.
We've had a lot of those recently.
That is true.
8:30, time for the news. Here's Drew.
Good morning. It's 6 degrees and mostly cloudy in Vancouver. Vancouver police have issued a warning about a convicted sex offender who has been released from custody and is now living in a halfway house in the city. Investigators believe Christian Otto Olsen poses a significant risk of reoffending. He has previously been convicted of sexual assault, child pornography offenses, and sexual interference and touching. There are several restrictions on his release. He has been ordered to wear an electronic monitoring device, and he's forbidden to be near places where children congregate, such as schools, parks, and rec centers. Police say Olsen is a potential threat to female and male children and teenagers. There's a picture of him on our website, cbc.ca/bc. It has been 7 months since a car crash that killed three people in Coquitlam, including two children. Now the parents of one of the victims is urging the city of Coquitlam to make a commitment to improving road safety. Megan Batchelor reports.
9-year-old Ella Hernandez was killed when she was riding in a vehicle involved in a collision on the Lougheed Highway in April. Her 3-year-old cousin also killed. Now her parents want the city of Coquitlam to agree to make the roads there safer. Stephen Brunel speaks for the family.
Even though this obviously won't bring Ella back, their focus is on how can they make sure, if they can, that this doesn't happen to another family in the future.
After repeated requests to the city and mayor for a meeting, they've been turned down. The city of Coquitlam says it won't do interviews on the matter or meet with the family as the collision is tied up in a lawsuit. Brunel says that's not a valid reason.
Whether they make a commitment to safety or not won't impact any lawsuit. This is a completely separate issue.
They're hoping the commitment would create a legacy of safety in Ella's name. Megan Batchelor, CBC News, Vancouver.
The mayor of Port Coquitlam says he doesn't know what's in store for the future, but his days in politics are coming to an end. Greg Moore says he won't be seeking re-election next year. He served as mayor of Port Coquitlam for 10 years and says it just feels like the right time to step down. Moore says he'll remain in office until the next civic election and says there's still a lot he'd like to accomplish, including the Downtown Action Plan and building a new rec center. He says he has no plans to run either federally or provincially. Trinity Western University is heading to the Supreme Court of Canada this week. The case is centered on the university's Christian-based community covenant. Among other things, it bans students from having sexual relations outside of heterosexual marriage. Several law societies across the country say the covenant infringes on equality rights guaranteed in the charter. But the law school's executive director, Earl Phillips, says there is no conflict.
We have the same rule for gays and straights. And the same rule is that sexual relations should be confined to marriage between a man and a woman. That applies to straight students as well as gay students.
Last year, courts of appeal in both BC and Nova Scotia ruled in favor of the university's arguments for religious freedom. Ontario's Court of Appeal ruled against it. The case will be heard in the Supreme Court of Canada tomorrow. There is some unusual activity going on at the Wildlife Rescue Association of BC in Burnaby. As Corey Correa explains, it says it could be the result of the wildfires this past summer.
Since August, the Wildlife Rescue Association has taken in 664 injured songbirds. That's 66% more than it took in last year during the fall migration. The rescue center also took in an injured white-winged crossbill, the first one in 10 years. Staff say something is markedly different than previous years, and nothing stands out more than BC's summer wildfires. Wendy Easton is a land bird biologist with the Canadian Wildlife Service. She says the service's songbird tracking in the Chilcotin, which was hit by wildfires this summer, saw far fewer birds this year.
Having the fires at the scale that we did and the extent that we did this year in British Columbia, we are likely to see some decreases or increases in bird numbers because of that.
Easton says the changing migration of songbirds, who help our ecosystem with pollination and pest control, could be the canary in the coal mine. But she says data is still coming in, so the jury is out on what this means for bird populations. Corey Correa, CBC News, Burnaby.
And some good news for Canadian tourists trapped on the Indonesian island of Bali because of an erupting volcano. The local airport has reopened because ash from Mount Agung is currently drifting away from aircraft flight paths. But an exclusion zone remains in place around the mountain because of the continuing threat of a further and possibly even more powerful eruption. Earlier this week, more than 400 Canadians were registered as tourists on Bali, including a Kelowna woman who hopes to be able to fly home tomorrow. It's now 8:35. That's the CBC News.
Spectacular pictures out of Bali.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Thank you, sir. Amy?
Yes.
Deep breath.
Not for me. The people stuck in there.
One of those days.
It has been especially horrible for people trying to get out of Surrey Delta today. We started off the morning with two separate problems north of the tunnel on Highway 99 and never really recovered from there. So at last check, it was still heavy from Highway 17, still very heavy for the Alex Fraser as that was an alternate route. And then we're seeing that delayed push volume to the night, the Oak and the Arthur Lang as people come through Richmond in towards Vancouver. So it's still going to be busy for a while. Still seeing a lot of volume on Highway 1 between Langley and Abbotsford in both directions, in fact. Burnaby Lake stretch just crawling. It's heavy off the North Shore. So, yes, it'll take some time. And that's with dry streets. We actually got off pretty lucky with the weather. We've seen increasing cloud, and we will get into the rain later on this afternoon. It'll be quite rainy and windy overnight and to start tomorrow before it tapers off to showers again.
Tomorrow on the program, something I know you'll be keenly interested in. You and I have spoken many times about pooling water.
Right.
And it's the lowly catch basin that seems to be the cause.
It's true.
Well, there are a few catch basins in need of some special care across the city. And so Margaret Gallagher is going to be here tomorrow to tell us about an Adopt a Basin program.
Haven't you always wanted to?
And I'm not making this up.
I know.
So we'll hear about that tomorrow on the Early Edition. That's it for us today. For Amy, for Drew, for the entire gang, I'm Rick Clough. We'll see you tomorrow.